You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the best of Flashpoints for the week of February 8th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we hear from AIM co-founder Bill Means. Also, we look at the devastating impact of Trump's policies at the U.S.-Mexico border in San Diego. And later, Pablo Alvarado of Andelan speaks out against the growing number of attacks on undocumented workers. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Monday's program with AIM co-founder Bill Means, who condemns the Trump's militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border and reflects on the devastating impact that Trump's government shutdown has had on Native communities all over the U.S.
Joining us to talk about this is Mr. Bill Means. He is the a co-founder of the American Indian Movement, and he's also a co-founder on the board of the International Indian Treaty Council. Bill Means, as you know, we're just back from Tucson. We saw the United Nations taking testimony from the local tribes and from the local indigenous nations about the impact of militarizations. Why don't you give us here on the heels of another speech by Trump, maybe he's going to declare a national emergency. Why don't you give us your view of the situation now and the implications of this expanding military operation?
Yes, I think this could be a very important turning point on the relations with not only Native Americans who live and cross the border every day, but all the communities along there, many of which have voted not to have a wall in their communities, both Indian and non-Indian communities in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, all the way through to California. So what this means is, I think with President Trump talking about declaring emergency, I think we're just about a breath away from martial law, where he could actually declare that emergency and then declare that the people, any resistance, may be treated as criminals, as he's already done to those people who came on the various caravans to the border. He said we gave permission to shoot 5 rounds. So they've already taken steps in a preliminary test, and nobody said anything. So all that militarization, and by the way, this ain't the first conference we've had. We had two American Indian Movement border conferences in the past, about 4 or 5 years ago. We were talking about the militarization because the Indian people had these forces, you know, Army National Guard, U.S. troops, FBI, U.S. Marshals, all these various jurisdictions descended on their land and said that this was due to the situation with migrants coming through unchecked. Well, people begin to die on the desert, which is we're coming into that season again. And every year, just across, for example, the Tono Oatum Reservation, which is dissected by the U.S. border with members of their tribe on both sides, they began to experience military occupation. And we witnessed that, and we took testimony on this 5-6 years ago. And now it's only worse, because the impact to the land itself, you know, the desert is a very, shall we say, delicate ecosystem. None of this is taken into account by the various forces, law enforcement people. They just consider that a non-issue. And so that people want to gather medicine, who go for ceremonies back and forth across the border all the time, they're impeded, they're halted, they have to produce various documents now, and they used to just walk back and forth. And they still feel that, you know, in their land, that's their right. So what we have here is a complete takeover by the administration, the Trump administration, in order to implement martial law, I believe, is the next step. And so, you know, it's a little ironic, especially historically, because here we have the American Indians who welcomed all these, and I mean all these, they could be called invaders, they could be called tourists, they could be called immigrants, and they were having signs put up all over Western Europe and Eastern Europe. This is back in about the 40s, 50s, we started to see waves of immigrants, and these signs that they had in Europe, of which I've seen myself, said free land. Free land, but they didn't tell the people they're giving away our land. So the policy of the United States towards indigenous people is we could do whatever we want to you, and you just have to accept it, which is a total violation of all standards of human rights. So this is one of the things that we as International Indian Treaty Council have been trying to establish the rule of law through human rights on the border. And believe me, there's plenty of non-Indian supporters, the churches, other organizations that have fought the United States on the issue of giving water to people who need it in the summertime. There's an average, used to be, and I'm sure it's still about the same, of 35 deaths every summer from about June to end of September just from lack of water, of people coming across the desert. Now, these are not people that are, as they say, criminals. They're looking for a better way of life for their family. Right? They're fleeing. They're escaping from military dictatorships, which the United States has allowed to take over so they can control the corporations and the resources in these lands of Honduras, lands of Costa Rica, lands of Panama, Mexico, Guatemala, all of Central America. And it is, once again, that same issue is coming to pass of natural resources and the exploitation of labor. These are the things of why United States companies go in there. So there's a sinister kind of background that we have the U.S. military protecting the corporation. You know, it's not unlike when they build these pipelines and the mineral developments of the extractive industries up here in North America, they do the same thing. They come across using eminent domain. They've even extended eminent domain to Canadian international companies, breaking all rights of our people, domestic law, and implementing all these changes based on violation of human rights. So these are some of my opinions, and here we have a very ironic situation that they came and stole our land from Europe, but yet when some of our relatives, the brown people, start coming from the south, all of a sudden it's a national emergency. Instead of a Statue of Liberty, they built a wall. And I think this is a shame to America, because even Ronald Reagan said, take down this wall, to Gorbachev over there in East Germany, West Germany. So this is the type of policies that the Trump administration is imposing on indigenous people in our communities. So we just went through, which I'm sure you bear witness, is the human rights hearings where we're trying to bring attention of the international community to the situation on the border, which a lot of time becomes isolated and becomes lost in the various other issues of impeachment, economy, of all these various issues that the White House is dealing with. And so it's time for America, the United Nations, and other institutions, the churches, to recommit themselves to the human rights of indigenous people, because we're the only ones that have a lot of the minerals left in this hemisphere. And so it has always been a game of land and resources. And now that whole issue is beginning to resurface under the guise of an immigration emergency. When we ourselves welcome these foreigners, these tourists, we welcome to this country. But yet when our people come, our relatives from the south, they want to make them into criminals. They want to make them into feeling unwelcome, when in fact, they're all willing. Almost all the people they interview, they say we're coming to work to do the jobs that Americans don't want to do and to make a better life for their families and escape the vast corruption and violence that takes place in their own countries of Central America.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking to Mr. William Means. He is a co-founder of the American Indian Movement. He is on the board of the International Indian Treaty Council. They have been collaborating with the United Nations. Bill Means has had many opportunities to guide the United Nations through the kinds of situations that are created by the U.S. government, the nature of poverty. Bill, I want to talk to you about poverty and the shutdowns. Where are you now? And tell us something about the impact, how indigenous communities are impacted directly and the first ones to suffer when Trump decides he's going to throw a tantrum and shut down the country.
Yes, you know, many of our people are under the payroll. I would say about 80% of the funds that come to reservations, which there are about over 515 reservations across the country representing thousands of acres of land. We see that the administration, when they began to shut down, of course, our people were affected first because we're under the guise to treaty obligation. Now, this is not welfare I'm talking about. This is not what they call Social Security are the payments that the government makes to various farmers, the millions of dollars that go to the Department of Agriculture for crops that fail, or subsidies for corn and soybeans and international trade. These are issues of survival because that's the only employment we have. And so here we are trying to run a hospital which serves 36 to 46 thousand Indian people on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and we don't have the funds coming in. They asked the people to work for free, which they did for about 2 weeks here. Our people were working for free because they don't want to see our people suffer. We have some of the lowest, most terrible health rates and issues with health throughout the whole country. And so it's very, very devastating to our communities to deal with these federal shutdowns because it impacts our community at the lowest level of the communities right away. And it seems as though the Trump administration didn't even mention the 3 million Indian people that are suffering every day because of his policies, asking them to work for free, which many of them did. And so here we have a travesty taking place here of denial of our treaty rights. Like I said, these are not welfare funds. These are not funds that the government gives us. We gave millions of acres of land, and we have treaties, legally binding treaties, that are as good today as they were the day they were signed. And so now we have to put up with this administration, not only human rights violations, treaty violations, but violations of our own Constitution, denying people the right to organize and stand up for these various shutdowns that take place at the whim, not even any type of justification from the Trump administration. And he goes on TV and says he's had the greatest administration ever for 2 years. Now, we all know that that's completely false. And so here he is living in his dream world that he's the best president that ever lived. And the denial of the rights of our people, the denial of human rights along the border, the denial of people's voice in the politics of local governments to stay free of these impositions by the army and the federal forces on the border. These are all things that we get directly immediately because we're impacted through treaty rights and through what are treaty claims. As I said, these were traded. These were contracts, these treaties, for the millions of acres of land, timber, resources that they took from our people. So we had to fight for that. Maybe some of you heard about General Custer back in 1876. Well, Custer, he was defeated. And so we had to resist this genocide that took place against our people, and here we're still here. in spite of all the various policies of the church, of the social service agencies, of the government, state, and federal, here we are. We're still surviving, but we're fighting every day for our rights, and that's an honor to stand up for your people. So our people are looking good. I mean, they're inspired. They're ready for a fight with Trump if we have to. We'd rather do peaceful opposition to the policies of the president. This is what our goal is. We're not a violent people. But when people have to depend on the government to survive or to get our treaty rights, to get our human rights, then we have no choice but to make a stand against these terrible policies.
And Bill Means, one of the major stands, and it continues, and it's been sort of on steroids in taking on Trump, is the fighting against the extraction companies, the draining of the resources, and the destroying of the sources of water. We've been in that battle together with you. We witnessed it at Standing Rock. Where does that sit now, and what's your take on that battle?
Well, unfortunately, the battle is in the courts. It's both unfortunate and fortunate. At least we're buying a little time so that we can continue to organize, we can continue to promote our human, basic human rights and our rights within the law so that these judges, you know, fortunately, through the years, they begin to understand a little bit about Indian law, which is a separate area of law because it applies only to Indians. But yet and still, we have to fight for every little decision that we get. I'll give you an example. Up there at Standing Rock, they ruled against the Indian tribes, the people, and allowed the pipeline to go through. However, now the judge put a stop to the work of the pipeline because they haven't done several things to get ready for any kind of emergency situation. They have no plans in case there's a spill because they have no way of detecting spill. All pipelines leak because they're man-made material. So then the other issue we have is cultural resources. It's federal law that on or near reservation in treaty territory, you have to consult with Indian tribes, Indian nations, in order to define the territories that may be sacred, they may have burials, they may have resources in that area that we have a right to find out what is there and what belongs to us. And so many of these cultural resources, many of these issues of safety, if there's a spill and there's other issues of what role does the Indian culture play in the courts of the United States in terms of our rights? Do we have rights to our original land? The treaty says yes. But yet and still, here we are fighting every day to get our basic human rights. But there is a little light at the end of the tunnel with some of these judges who are realizing they can be defeated on a appeals court and on these various issues, cultural survival, also the extractive industries just imposing. Like I said, this is a Canadian company in the case of Standing Rock that is imposing their will using eminent domain on domestic Indian people that are members of this country. We had no voice in that. So that's one of the things that's really, should we say, very, very disturbing and a total violation of human rights.
And finally, Bill, I want to get your broad view and your response. We now see the governor of Virginia is sort of caught in a situation where he's either in blackface or in a Klan uniform. First he admits it repeatedly, and then he denies it repeatedly. But everybody knows there's a big problem here. And this is in Virginia, you know, sort of like Klan land. The history of the Klan is huge and strong there. Your thoughts on this and sort of this version of the manifestation of racism?
Well, I think this manifestation is kind of encouraged by the policies of the Trump administration. I mean, you know what happened in Charlottesville, various places where racism has reared its ugly head. Little or no response from the administration. So, in fact, he's encouraging this type of behavior by racist people that have a history of mistreating not only black people, but indigenous people, or whether it's Mexican-Americans, whether it's those people from the South, the immigrants that are coming over. We call them migrants because they have a right to be here. Immigrants are something that has to have a legal standing. We don't believe in that as indigenous people. Those are our relatives. We're all part Mayan. We're all part Lakota. We're all part, this is the indigenous people. But in these cases where racism has become very evident, like in Virginia, we just have to battle every day because Dr. King, he didn't give up. They had to kill him. And still we have these struggles to maintain our dignity, to maintain our place in society, equal access, equal rights, all these things that many people have fought so hard for. And so we're not giving up. We view this as just a shot in the arm for our people to organize, and the political races are coming up, and this is a good way to organize the people is in and around the future political leaders of our country, including Trump.
And you actually have been involved in that. Are you hopeful, given the number of interesting new candidates, indigenous candidates, women, some voices that we haven't heard anymore? Is that an inspiration to you, Bill?
Oh, yeah. This is, you know, part of always a part of the American Indian Movement's policies nationally and internationally with the Treaty Council is a right to self-determination. That's a basic human right. And so we view this as an absolute obligation of our people to get involved. And we see the tide begin to turn that some of our people are saying, yes, I can make a difference in this political race, this local race, this national race. You know, and so our people are getting involved in these issues locally as well as nationally. And I think that's a great inspiration, especially for our young people. Because we can't sit back and depend on the ministers, depend on the priests, depend on the United States government to take care of us. We got to take care of ourselves, and that's our right.
Mr. Bill Means, co-founder of the American Indian Movement, on the board of the International Indian Treaty Council, somebody who knows a great deal, probably more than anybody else, about broken treaties and the laws that the United States has violated in what I consider an ongoing genocide against indigenous communities where they live and where they've been for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Bill, as always, it's a privilege to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much. And my heart goes out to the Bay Area and to our relatives on the border that are still resisting the genocidal policies of the United States government.
Thanks, Bill. You take care now. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
To the best of Flashpoints for the week of February 8th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview from Tuesday's show as we look at the devastating impact of Trump policies at the U.S.-Mexico border in San Diego.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And as we get ready to hear the State of the Union here on Pacifica, we wanted to get a sense of somebody who knows a lot about the State of the Union when it comes to the border politics and the impact of the militarization. And that's Enrique Morones. He is the founder of the Border Angels. He was a former Major League Baseball executive. Now he spends a lot of time trying to prevent people from dying on the desert based on this incredibly brutal refugee policy. Enrique Morones, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Dennis, I'm glad to be back. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, but a lot of people are suffering based on this policy. Why don't you just begin by giving us your sense? You've watched this unfolding, expanding militarization. You've seen the impact. Talk a little bit about your observations and what it looks like from in the eyes of somebody who's been fighting, bringing water to the desert, and trying to call attention to this situation.
Sure. So never have we been in the situation that we are now, where you have the biggest, you know, we do have an emergency. There is a crisis, but that emergency and crisis is at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That is a national crisis, and its name is Donald Trump. And his hateful rhetoric has not only caused fear, you know, along the U.S.-Mexican border and across the country, but all over the world. His actions and pulling out of certain parts of the world where the U.S. should not have been in to begin with, his disruption of various political issues in South America, like in Venezuela, et cetera. He's causing trouble all over the world. And tonight he's going to say that he wants to bring people together. There has never been a person that's brought people more apart in my lifetime. And being on the border, being right here on the border just yesterday, some Republican congressmen came down here as they did a tour of the border, and I was asked, not by them, because, of course, they don't ask the people that are on the front lines. They only ask law enforcement what they think. I was asked by one of the media people here, are they talking to you about their visit to San Diego? I go, no. They're not talking to the nonprofit organizations. They're not talking to the migrants on both sides of the wall. They're not talking to the people that live right next to the border about the realities. San Diego has been a very safe city for a long, long time. It continues to be a safe city. Undocumented migration has never been lower in my lifetime. And, you know, Trump is trying to paint this as ISIS and all these criminals and so forth. I go, the biggest criminal is him, Donald Trump. And what's taking place right now is unheard of. The caravans of people that are coming are caravans that have traveled around the world since the beginning of time. These people are traveling in numbers because of safety. They're escaping hunger or violence in their home countries, and they have every right to be traveling. And what he's doing is he's trying to paint them as trying to raise havoc in the United States, et cetera. That is not true. So he's got the Border Patrol in the San Diego sector shooting tear gas at women and children. We have the situation where we've had people that have jumped over the wall and turned themselves in, seeking asylum. And Donald Trump is literally having the Border Patrol agents walk them back to the wall and jump back over into Mexico. I mean, there's total disrespect of international law, and this is Donald Trump. So it's a very scary situation. He delivers a very scary message, and we've got to continue to stand up and resist his hate and his lies.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking to really a hero of mine, Enrique Morones, who founded Border Angels. In another lifetime, he was a Major League Baseball executive and has since turned his attention to calling attention to what's been happening at the border, the failure of immigration policy, and on it goes. Could you talk a little bit about the current situation, how people are being treated? What does happen? Is it possible now for somebody to apply for asylum, or is it so brutal at the border? Are there so many roadblocks that it's become impossible?
It's almost impossible. Being able to ask for asylum is an international law. The United States has never been very welcoming in giving asylum to these people, but at least people were able to go to the port of entry and ask for it. Now, what the Trump administration has done doesn't allow the people to even go to the port of entry, or they take a very small group of people that are camping out, that, you know, it has been, you know, pouring rain down here like it has up there the last few days, And so people are getting frustrated. There's no room for them at the inn, so to speak. And they're getting desperate because they're escaping. Mainly the people that are here now on the Mexican side are from Honduras, some from El Salvador, some from Guatemala. And they're saying, you know, I'm escaping a horrific situation that's not my fault because of the violence that's taking place in these countries, a lot of it due to U.S. policies and the U.S. demand for drugs, et cetera. Yet I can't ask for asylum. What do I do? So there's been people that have been telling them, jump over the wall, turn yourselves in. And we do not recommend that, but some people have been doing that. They're being shot by the Border Patrol. They're shooting tear gas at the women and the children. They're walking people back that have already turned themselves into Border Patrol while they're walking through the desert. They're being walked back to the border, forced to go back over the wall, totally against the law. And I've been talking to national media about exposing this situation. Here's an administration, the only administration that I know of that has not only dehumanized the people, then taken the children from their parents, put the children in cages, tear gassed the children. And as you know, Dennis, in December, two children died in Border Patrol custody in New Mexico, Felipe and Jacqueline, 7 and 8 year old Guatemalan. The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. And he continues with his hateful rhetoric, his lies, and painting the other as if the other was something bad. We are all one family, one human family. We should all be treated with dignity and respect. And that's the last thing that that Donald Trump has been doing. And in San Diego, we have a very racist Border Patrol chief named Rodney Scott. And he is the worst of all the Border Patrol chiefs along the border. Because here, some of these things that I've been telling you about walking people back to the wall, making them jump over, tear gassing women and children, is only happening in the San Diego sector. That's not happening in Arizona or New Mexico or Texas. In Texas, they still allow the children to hug their parents at the border, something we've done here for a long time before Trump, before Rodney Scott. So the situation in this sector is in many cases worse than it is along the rest of the U.S.-Mexican border. We don't need a wall. We don't need and Trump has not built any more wall. And I hope that Nancy Pelosi stands firm about not one penny for any new wall, because wall is the wrong message. It doesn't stop anybody. It just leads people to die, and it just slows them down. Right now it takes about 16, 17 seconds to jump over the wall that exists. If Trump were to double the height of the wall, it would take 30 seconds. So it doesn't stop anybody. And it's really an old relic of hate. And, you know, everybody wants to have humane borders, intelligent borders, not these old-fashioned borders with the great walls that, you know, we've seen in centuries past. So it's a very critical time for us. And that's why we need to stand up, say no to this racism, say no to this hate. And so the State of the Union address, I was not going to watch it, but I've been asked by an international media to make comments on it. So I'm going to go and sit in their booth and watch it, and they make comments about, you know, we know what's going to happen. He's going to make these false claims, continuing to insist on a wall, continuing to insist that he's going to make an emergency declaration. If there really was an emergency, why would he wait? If I have an emergency, I don't wait 15, 30, 45 days. I take action immediately. There is no emergency at the border. There's an emergency at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
There's also an emergency in terms of what we're learning about the number of children that have been separated from their parents. Apparently, the Trump administration has been lying all along. And as bad as it seemed from what we knew, it's a lot worse, isn't it? What do we know about that? We know that there are a lot of kids missing. We don't know where they are, right?
We don't know where they are. And it was all based on a lie, and the fact that once they were called on it, that they were going to be brought back together. And they said that they were bringing everybody back together. They can't bring people back together when they don't know where they're at. They never should have been separated in the first place. President Obama, you know, he had his faults as well. I, in general, support President Obama. But he didn't do this. He wasn't taking children away from their parents. He wasn't putting children in cages. He wasn't tear gassing children. And what Donald Trump has done is a shameful, because the society is judged on how we treat our children. How dare him take children from their parents and then place them with other families or place them in places where nobody knows where they're at? It is just such an inhumane type of a situation that the rest of the world is going, really? The United States does that? And I say, yeah, Donald Trump does that. And he's got his cronies allowing it to happen. And it's totally unacceptable. Donald Trump is the one that belongs behind bars. He's the one that should be separated from his family.
Have things gotten worse with the expanding privatization of the prison system, particularly in dealing with refugees? That has not worked out well, has it?
No, it hasn't. And, you know, these facilities where the children and the parents have been at were never made for children. They were detention facilities because before the undocumented population, which is at all-time lows, before the undocumented population was mainly men that were crossing the border looking for work. And those conditions were bad enough for them. Well, now these facilities, these private prisons, they call them, ICE refrigerators and cages and so forth. There's children sleeping on the floor, separated from their parents. There's chicken wire around there. It's just an inhumane situation. That's what led to the death of the two children from Guatemala. That's what's led to a lot of these children. We've heard of two deaths, but there's a lot of children that are ill, that are in situations where they need medical attention and they're not being cared for.
And I'm hearing, and this is really troubling, that there is I guess people are inspired and courageous in having hunger strikes, but I'm now hearing about force feedings of people who are hunger striking in these ICE prisons. What do you know about that? Force feeding.
Right. Because of the fact that they were going on hunger strikes to protest the conditions, they didn't want to have more deaths while they're being detained by the Department of Homeland Security. So they're force feeding these migrants. They're treating these migrants the way we used to read about in the history books, things that happened overseas in Nazi Germany, in the 1940s. It is horrific. We never thought we would see this type of a situation. And I always remind people that when what happened in Nazi Germany, during World War II, it started off with a trickle and then it became a tsunami. Well, we're halfway there. That trickle is long gone from being a trickle. Now that children are dying in detention, the separation of the children, the force feeding, history is repeating itself, and too many people are standing by, not doing anything.
I'm wondering if there's any hope, if you've had any communication. I believe you have a dual citizenship for the United States and Mexico. I'm wondering if you have been able to monitor any kind of change. Is the new leadership in Mexico have any power here, or are they going to go along with the status quo?
I'm a fan of the new president in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, but I do not support the fact that they're allowing some of these asylum seekers to be returned to Mexico while they wait out their case. That's something he told me. I was in Mexico in December as he became the new president, that was not going to happen. So it started to happen. There's been a lot of protest about this. I don't think it's going to last too long. But even doing it with a couple of dozen people or so that he's done it with so far is absolutely wrong. These people are seeking asylum. They're not planning to go back to they're sending people back to Tijuana right now. And now they're going to be sending people back to Ciudad Juarez, which is right below Texas, El Paso. That's unacceptable. That's unacceptable. When somebody's seeking asylum, you're not supposed to all of a sudden send them back to another country to wait out their case. So I was very disappointed by the Mexican government allowing this to happen. They say, because we've had meetings, they said it's a unilateral decision. And I go, yeah, but you could just say no. Even though they made the decision, the U.S. government, you could say no and not allow them to come back. So we're pressuring, we and a lot of other people are pressuring the Mexican government to put an end to this, because the people that have been wanting to get asylum, once they're returned to Mexico, even though they're not from Mexico, they're from Central America, it's very unlikely that they'll ever get asylum. It's too easy to say no. The attorneys cannot go see them in Mexico. The attorneys from the U.S. they don't have the permission to practice law in Mexico. The people that are in Mexico, it's very difficult for them to see an attorney in the U.S. now. It complicates matters. It makes it even more difficult.
And if you were advising, obviously Trump is hopeless, and he really has demonstrated that he is a serial white supremacist. But if speaking to some of the more progressive members of Congress, what kind of advice would you be giving them at this point in terms of focusing on humane reform? What would you be saying as an advisor?
I would say stay firm to the not 1 cent for the wall. Do not give in to the $5.6 billion or even even $600 to build. Don't give in to that. Don't give in to that because it's the Trump base that's freaking out because he promised them that he was going to build a wall. The Mexican government is not going to pay one penny. Most people in the United States do not want that wall. That wall is it's not going to help anything except help kill people. So my advice would be to hold firm. If he does another government lockout, it's only going to hurt Trump even further, but it's going to hurt those families that are left without pay, and this is insane. He's talking about security issues, and the people that really do keep us secure, the people that are working as TSA agents, the Coast Guard, they're not going to be paid, and all of a sudden you're going to have trouble at the airports, the people are going to be tired, the inspectors are going to be mad. It's a lot easier for something to slip through that could bring another 9/11 situation. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. So if he's really concerned about security, which you don't know what Trump is concerned about besides himself, then you would not be doing these government shutdowns. So I think that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats need to hold firm, not give in to this rhetoric, and then we need to continue this investigation on the Trump administration because Donald Trump belongs behind bars. Michael Pence is horrific as well. But we need to make sure that we start, pressuring even further, the demanding that this investigation come to some sort of a conclusion. Because Donald Trump, Michael Pence, and that whole group, they belong behind bars.
And I want to conclude sort of where we started. Enrique Morones, you founded the Border Angels because there was life and death work to be done, that you needed to be, among other things, bringing supplies to the desert so that people would not die on the desert, water to the desert. Is that situation worse now? Is it more difficult given the current policies? Are more people dying on the desert?
Well, people continue to die in the desert. And as you saw, our friends in Arizona with no more deaths, several of them were sentenced to go to jail because they were saving people's lives. The Border Patrol is also being more aggressive out here in San Diego and Imperial Valley where we're being harassed. We are being harassed while we're out there putting water. Instead of leaving us alone doing our saving humanitarian work that other organizations do, now they're coming up and interfering. Where's your permits? You're not supposed to be out here. The more they do that, the more we're going to do it. The more we're going to be out there putting water, they're not going to stop us. And it's important that we resist, that we stand up, because justice is something that we can need to continue to fight for. And we're not going to be intimidated. We're going to stand up for justice and continue to do our work.
All right. Well, we want to thank you very much for the incredible work that you do and for taking the time out, Enrique, to talk to us about that life and death work and what the situation really is, what people really need to be thinking about when they listen to this speech tonight and they hear about the wall and threats of brown people who are taking over the country. Again, thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Sure, thank you. And BorderAngels.org, I want to thank three people that just came by and dropped off donations from San Francisco. They drove all the way down here, Gina, Sarah, and Aubrey. They heard about the need, and they said, we want to help. And they came down to bring donations and continue to allow us to continue to serve our migrant brothers and sisters.
Beautiful way to end this interview. Thanks, Enrique. Good luck. Be careful.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Tell her she can't manage. Now you can't change the way she feels.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we close the show with an interview from Wednesday's program with Pablo Alvarado of Endilon, speaking out against the growing number of attacks on undocumented workers.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are really honored to be joined again by Pablo Alvarado. He's the executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, also Endilon, and he is a major organizer for the folks who do some of the hardest work in this country and oftentimes get ripped off because perhaps they might be undocumented. Pablo Alvarado, good to have you back on Flashpoints. A lot is going on. We're seeing the expanding militarization. Despite the battle in Washington, they're digging at the border and they're disrupting life. You want to give us your sense of where this battle is right now? You've been in D.C. You've been fighting with the politicians. You've stood against it. You've been arrested against it. Give us an idea of where you think this battle is now. Is Trump going to get his wall? What does this mean?
Well, what this moment means for the day labor community, for the immigrant community, is not different than the moment in which Mr. Trump assumed power, or even when Barack Obama was the president. During the Democratic administration, when Obama was in power, the migrant community was a football kicked from one end to the other. And both parties have decided to use the issue of migration as a wedge issue. The Republicans energized their base by opposing immigrants, by attacking immigrants. And the Democrats also speak to a significant segment of their base. But they also like the issue because that's how the Republicans get to say all the things that comes out of their mouths, that the racist statements and horrible epithets against immigrants. So it appears that they both want to use the issue as a wedge issue rather than finding a solution. If you think about the wall, they both want the wall, and they both talk about border security with the same intentions, with the same ideas, sending a message of deterrence to future immigrants, telling people you're not welcome. The only difference is that Mr. Trump wants a physical barrier, and the Democrats want a lot of cameras, sensors, drones, and more agents, obviously. The only thing that they don't want, it appears, so far is the wall. So from any angle that you see it, it doesn't look good for immigrants. And for the TPS holders and also for the DACA recipients, is even worse because they've been used as a negotiating point, and in which their life, their future, is being essentially, put at risk. And they're telling them, look, it's the wall for your future. And it's terrible what's happening because I don't think that the Democrats are going to give Mr. Trump his wall. And, the Democrats don't want to negotiate the wall in exchange for DACA and TPS. Apparently, the proposal that Mr. Trump has put forward is not necessarily the best proposal. It's not even a permanent fix. He wants a permanent wall, but he does not want to give a permanent fix to TPS holders and DACA recipients. So, and the Democrats obviously don't want to give him his wall because that is his main campaign promise. And if he gets his wall, he's going to do better during the re-election campaign, during the re-election efforts, And the irony, the Democrats believe that if they don't give him his wall, that they can come back with an immigration reform proposal and expect that Republicans support it. And again, I don't think that Trump is going to give them anything after the Democrats don't want to give him anything either. So the way it's looking, it's like we're going to keep arguing about this issue in the coming years. And obviously, the threat of the government shutdown, it doesn't necessarily help. But But there we are. It hasn't, things haven't changed for migrants. I think things have worsened for migrants.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Pablo Alvarado. We don't have the best line, but what he has to say is incredibly important. Pablo Alvarado is the head of ENDILON. That's the National Day Labor Organizing Network. And he works with day laborers all over the country, documented, undocumented. The struggle continues. I'm wondering if, given... we know that Obama was bad, but Trump has sort of turned it up a little bit more. Has, for the folks that you represent, has life changed? Is life worse, or is it just a constant fear of deportation or being discovered or being used as a pawn or being turned in? I mean, I noticed that Trump had to fire a few people because they weren't documented.
Well, there is widespread fear among the immigrant community, and a lot of, and similarly, for example, we know that the number of hate crimes and hate incidents has increased across the country. Similarly, there has been an increase in wage theft cases. In terms of, like, for example, deportations, there is more people getting arrested, but there are less people getting deported. And that is because, in a way, we have built layers of protections for undocumented people who are in removal proceedings. And second, because immigrants are not just signing their voluntary departure. They are lawyering up, and they are fighting their cases. So as a consequence, the number of deportations is really down. Because of the rise of Trump and because of his rhetoric, the number of wage theft cases has also increased. More people are coming forward to report wage theft, but there are less people who are willing to go through the process to recover those unpaid wages because of fear. So the lives of immigrants have definitely changed under this president. There's more abuse, there's more fear, but I also want to let you know that there are people fighting back, and that as I said, immigrants are not just signing and giving up their rights. They're lawyering up. They're fighting against their deportations. And those are signals that even though there is fear, the people are capable of losing that fear. And as a matter of fact, it would be good for the entire country if people lose that fear, because that's the only way that they can orchestrate a rational and effective defense when people lose their fear. You cannot defend yourself when you're fearful.
And I have to get your gut reaction. We now know a great deal more about the sort of the Trump kidnapping operation. We're hearing that there are hundreds, thousands more kids who are missing based on this family splitting policy. Your gut reaction, your thoughts, what can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, it is part of the same strategy. If people think that the Trump administration wasn't really planning and thinking clearly about the implications of their, family separation, the child separation policy, then people are wrong and mistaken. They did it because they wanted to send a very strong message of deterrence to the future flow of migrants. But they also wanted to normalize the mistreatment of migrants. So if they mistreat children, if they put them in cages, and for a segment of the population, that kind of treatment becomes normal, then folks would not speak out against worse atrocities against our community. So the Trump administration knew exactly when they were signing up for this child separation policy. And is one of the most grotesque measures that this administration has ever taken. And of course, this was to be expected. ICE and the Border Patrol are agencies that are fully out of control. There is no, you know, nobody is monitoring what they do. So they don't even, they're hiring people. They don't necessarily have the right training. And of course, you know, this is what ends up happening. They're losing the kids and they can no longer connect them with their parents. And now they don't know what to do. What's going to happen is that they're going to see a bunch of lawsuits that are going to be international in nature coming against the Trump administration if they don't reunite mothers and fathers with their sons and daughters. And that's where things are going, you know. So definitely this is perhaps one of the most grotesque measures that this government has ever taken.
Wow. Well, just before we let you go, in the final 30 seconds, what are your thoughts? What are you hoping for? Tell us about your battle. You say that there's resistance. People are fighting back. Where's your battle now?
Well, right now, I can tell you that starting from the 10th to the 13th of this month, there will be 3,000 TPS holders walking the halls of Congress in Washington, D.C., talking to the new legislators, talking to both Republicans and Democrats. They're going to be marching on the 12th in the streets of Washington, D.C. There are about 200, if separating about 3,000 kids from their parents in the U.S.-Mexico border created a crisis of morality for the country, imagine separating 200,000 kids from their TPS holder parents. That's exactly what's at stake here, and the TPS holders are at risk of being deported. And if this happens, the crisis that we have at the U.S.-Mexico border will be 100 times worse with the separation of over 200,000 children from their parents. So this week, this coming week, the TPS holders will be speaking truth to power. They're going to be even filing a lawsuit against the administration for terminating the TPS of Honduras and the brothers and sisters from Nepal. So we will continue fighting in the streets, in the legal system, and in the court of public opinion. And we want to make sure that people continue to lose their fear, because that's the only way that we could defend ourselves and defend our rights. It doesn't matter how fearful you are, you have to ensure that you exercise your rights. That's what Mr. Trump wants. He wants us to give up our rights and not to fight back, and essentially self-deport. So every time that we accept his measures, we are normalizing his ideas, and we are not resisting.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. But again, we thank you, Pablo Alvarado, the director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, an incredibly important organization defending the rights of some of the workers who do the hardest work in this country and face all kinds of intimidation, arrest, deportation, you name it, it happens. So we thank you for your great work in that regard.
Thank you. Have a good day.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, journalist and prophet Chris Hedges is back with a new hard-hitting speech. I hope you'll stay tuned. Over the past decade or so, Chris Hedges has emerged as one of the most powerful, most active voices on the American left. He is the author of now 16 books. I have read 5 of his books. I especially like and recommend Death of the Liberal Class from 2010 and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt from 2012. He published his latest book in late 2018. It is titled America, the Farewell Tour, and his talk this week bears the same name. Like his fellow left progressives, Michael Parenti and Richard Wolff, Hedges traces the sad state of America today back to a historical event that happened around 1970. The big business interests in the United States got together and decided that the country had developed too much actual democracy. The lower classes were getting too prosperous and too powerful. Corporate profits were lower than the moguls wanted. Too much was going to the workers and not enough to the stockholders. The fat cats decided to organize and fight back, to increase their control of all branches of government, to increase their control over all other institutions of public life, universities, regulatory agencies, the mass media, both political parties, you name it. And they did. For them, it was money and effort well invested. And, as Hedges has said on several occasions, they won. They pulled off a corporate coup d'etat. We are now living in the aftermath, and the living is not easy. The corporate interests now completely control all 3 branches of government, both political parties, and almost all public institutions. What to do? For Hedges, first we have to understand what happened. Then we have to fight back appropriately. And the only plausible way of fighting back successfully is through concerted, nonviolent resistance. Like the Yellow Vests in France, but without any of their occasional violence. These are familiar themes with Hedges, and we'll hear variations on these themes again today. But if the themes are familiar, many of the examples and connections are new and interesting. For instance, today Hedges begins by discussing the sociologist Emile Durkheim. Durkheim's observations 1 century ago predicted and explain pretty nicely America today. Hedges spoke in New York City on December 9, 2018. Here is Chris Hedges.
The French sociologist Emile Durkheim, in his book On Suicide, examined the disintegration of social bonds that drive individuals and societies to personal and collective acts of self-destruction. He found that when social bonds are strong, individuals achieve a healthy balance between individual initiative, self-actualization, and communal solidarity, which he called a life-sustaining equilibrium. These individuals and communities, he found, have the lowest rates of suicide. The individuals and societies most susceptible to self-destruction, he wrote, are those for whom these social bonds, this equilibrium, have been shattered. Societies are held together by a web of social bonds that give individuals a sense of being part of a collective and engaged in a project larger than the self. This collective expresses itself through meaningful work, democratic participation, worship, and values, and even patriotism, and shared national beliefs. The bonds provide meaning, a sense of purpose, status, and dignity. They offer psychological protection from impending mortality and meaninglessness that comes with being isolated and rejected. The disintegration of these bonds plunges individuals into deep psychological distress that leads ultimately to acts of self-annihilation. Durkheim called this state of hopelessness and despair anomie, which he defined as rulelessness. Rulelessness means the norms that govern a society and create a sense of organic solidarity no longer function. The belief, for example, that if we work hard, obey the law, and get a good education, we can achieve stable employment, social status, and mobility, along with financial security, is no longer true. The old rules that were imperfect and often excluded poor people of color, nevertheless were not a complete fiction in the United States. They offered some Americans, especially those from the white working and middle class, modest social and economic advancement. But the capture of political and economic power by corporate elites, along with the redirecting of all institutions toward the further consolidation of their power and wealth, has broken the social bonds that held the American society together. This rupture has unleashed a widespread malaise and self-destructiveness Durkheim would have recognized. When society is strongly integrated, he wrote, it keeps individuals in a state of dependency, holding them to be in its service and consequently not permitting them to dispose of themselves as they wish. Society is thus opposed to them escaping from their obligations towards it through death. The bond that attaches them to their common purpose attaches them to life, and in any case, the high goal towards which their gaze is turned alleviates the suffering that they feel from life's troubles. Finally, in a coherent and vital community, there is a continual exchange of ideas and feelings from all to each and from each to all, which is like mutual moral support, so that the individual, instead of being reduced to his or her resources only, participates in the collective energy and draws on it when his or hers is exhausted. Our corporate coup d'etat and our failed democracy has freed the oligarchs from all legal and moral constraints. The state of disorganization or anomie is thus reinforced by the fact that passions are less disciplined at a time when they need stronger discipline, Durkheim noted, of the avarice of the rich. It is not for nothing that so many religions have celebrated the benefits and the moral value of poverty, Durkheim wrote. This is because of all schools. It is the one that best teaches humankind to restrain itself. By obliging us to exercise constant discipline over ourselves, it prepares us to accept collective discipline with docility, while wealth, by exalting the individual, constantly risks awakening the spirit of rebellion that is the very font of immortality. Professor Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, in their study of legislative laws, wrote, "The central point that emerges from our research is that the economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence. In essence, the electoral process is a facade, one where we choose between the friendly and inclusive form of corporate fascism under the Democratic Party or the raw, racist, Christian fascism of Donald Trump's white man's party. The economic structures, like the political structures, have been reconfigured to keep the working class in a state of constant distress. American productivity, as the New York Times pointed out, has increased 77% since 1973, but hourly pay has grown by only 12%. If the federal minimum wage was attached to productivity, it would be more than $20 an hour, not $7.25 an hour. Some 41.7 million workers, a third of the U.S. workforce, earn less than $12 an hour. And most of them do not have access to employer-sponsored health insurance. A decade after the 2008 financial meltdown, the Times noted, the average middle-class family's net worth is more than $40,000 below what it was in 2007, and the net worth of black families has declined by 40%, and for Latino families, this figure has dropped by 46%. The financial crisis of 2008 saw the world's central banks, including the Federal Reserve, inject trillions of dollars of fabricated money into the global financial system. The Federal Reserve, which is supposed to regulate banks alone, handed over an estimated $29 trillion of fabricated money to American banks, according to researchers at the University of Missouri. $29 trillion. Kevin Sees and Margaret Flowers from Popular Resistance wrote, one-sixth of this could provide a $12,000 annual basic income, which would cost $3.8 trillion annually, doubling Social Security payments to $22,000 annually, would cost $662 billion. And a $10,000 bonus for all U.S. public school teachers would cost $11 billion. Free college for all high school graduates would cost $318 billion, and universal preschool would cost $38 billion. National improved Medicare for all would actually save the nation trillions of dollars over a decade. The Fed and other central banks cut interest rates to near zero, and some central banks in Europe instituted negative interest rates, meaning they would pay borrowers to take loans. The Fed, in a clever bit of accounting, even permitted distressed banks to use these no-interest loans to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. The banks gave the bonds back to the Fed and received 0.25% interest from the Fed. In short, the banks were loaned money at virtually no interest by the Fed and then were paid interest by the Fed on the money they borrowed. The Fed also bought up worthless derivatives and other toxic assets from the banks. And since federal authorities could fabricate as much money as they wanted, it did not matter if what they were buying was worthless. This fabricated money has created a worldwide debt of $325 trillion, more than three times global GDP. The fabricated money was hoarded by banks and corporations, loaned by banks at predatory interest rates, used to service interest on often unsustainable debt, or spent buying back stock, providing billions in compensation for the ruling elites. The fabricated money was not provided to the victims of financial fraud, but the victimizers. It was not invested in the real economy. Products were not manufactured and sold. Workers were not reinstated into the middle class with sustainable incomes, benefits, and pensions. Infrastructure projects were not undertaken. The fabricated money reinflated massive financial bubbles built on debt and papered over a fatally diseased financial system destined for collapse. The criminal irresponsibility of these elites was simply perpetrated again on an even more massive scale. What will trigger the next crash? The $13.2 trillion in unsustainable U.S. household debt? The $1.5 trillion in student debt? The billions Wall Street has invested in the fracking industry that has spent $280 billion more than it generates from its profits? Who knows? What is certain is that a global financial crash, one that may dwarf the meltdown of 2008, is inevitable. And this time, with interest rates near zero, the elites have no plan B. The financial structure will disintegrate. The global economy will go into a death spiral. The rage of a betrayed and impoverished population will, I fear, further empower right-wing demagogues who promise vengeance on the global elites, moral renewal, and a nativist revival, heralding a return to a mythical time when immigrants, women, and people of color knew their place, and in the United States, a Christianized fascism. Given the staggering amount of fabricated money that has to be repaid, the banks need to build greater and greater pools of debt. This is why when you are late in paying your credit card, the interest rate jumps to 28%. This is why if you declare bankruptcy, you are still responsible for paying off your student loan, even as 1 million people a year default on student loans, with 40% of all borrowers expected to default on student loans by 2023. This all comes from the New York Times, by the way. This is why wages are stagnant or have declined, while costs from health care and pharmaceutical products to bank fees and basic utilities are skyrocketing. This is why the federal government, further stripped of $1.5 trillion over the next decade by the Trump tax cuts, will soon pay more in interest on its debt than it spends on the military, Medicaid, or children's programs combined. Within a decade, more than $900 billion in interest payments will be due annually. Interest on debt is now the fastest growing major government expense. The cost of interest will hit $390 billion next year, and that's nearly a 50% increase from 2017, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The global financial system is a ticking time bomb. The question is not if it will explode, but when it will explode. And once it does, the inability of the global speculators to use fabricated money with zero interest to paper over the debacle will trigger massive unemployment, high prices for imports and basic services, and very probably a devaluation of the dollar when it is abandoned as the world's reserve currency. No one knows when this will happen, although the historian Alfred McCoy says the American Empire, as we know it, will no longer exist by 2030. This manufactured financial tsunami will transform the United States, already a failed democracy, into an authoritarian police state, awash in weapons and driven by hate. Life will become very cheap, especially for the vulnerable, undocumented workers, Muslims, poor people of color, girls and women, anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist critics who will be branded as agents of a foreign power. All will be demonized and persecuted for the collapse. The ruling elites, in a desperate bid to cling to their unchecked power and obscene wealth, will sanction indiscriminate violence against any group or individual they fear could instigate a revolt. Empires in decay, ravaged by widespread enemy, embrace an almost willful suicide. Blinded by their hubris and unable to face the reality of their diminishing power, they retreat into a fantasy world where hard and unpleasant facts no longer intrude. They replace diplomacy, multilateralism, participatory politics with a constant mobilization against enemies, real or invented. This self-delusion of late empire saw the United States make the greatest strategic blunder in its history, one that sounded the death knell of the American empire, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. The architects of the war in the George W. Bush White House and the array of useful idiots in the press and academia who were cheerleaders for it knew very little about the countries being invaded, were stunningly naive about the effects of industrial warfare, and were blindsided by the ferocious blowback. They stated and probably believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, although they had no valid evidence to support this claim. They insisted that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and spread across the Middle East. They assured the public that U.S. troops would be greeted by grateful Iraqis and Afghans as liberators. They promised that the oil revenues would cover the cost of reconstruction. They insisted that the bold and quick military strike, shock and awe, would restore American hegemony in the region and dominance in the world. It did the opposite. Historians of empire call these military fiascos a feature of all late empires. Micromilitarism. The Athenians engaged in micromilitarism when during the Peloponnesian War they invaded Sicily, suffering the loss of 200 ships and thousands of soldiers and triggering revolts throughout the empire. Britain engaged in 1956 in micromilitarism when it attacked Egypt in a dispute over the nationalization of the Suez Canal and then quickly withdrew in humiliation, empowering a string of Arab nationalist leaders such as Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser and dooming British rule over the nation's few remaining colonies. Neither of these empires recovered. Empires, because they rely on the power to dominate and exploit other countries, are in fact very fragile. Once this ability to dominate is gone, they unravel swiftly. A year for Portugal, 2 years for the Soviet Union, 8 years for France, 11 years for the Ottoman Empire, 17 for Great Britain, and in all likelihood, 27 years for the United States, counting from the crucial year 2003 when we invaded Iraq. Empires are hollowed out from the inside. Their cities fall into decay. And I just come from the New York subway system. 22-minute wait in Penn Station for the next subway. The decline sees the brutality abroad matched by a growing brutality at home. Militarized police gunned down, mostly unarmed, poor people of color, and fill a system of penitentiaries and jails that hold a staggering 25% of the world's prisoners, although we are only 5% of the world's population. The population at home, like the subjugated population abroad, lives under wholesale surveillance. Public services, including public education, infrastructure, and public transportation, become decrepit and dysfunctional. This rulelessness, this anomie, is best seen in the strata of our judiciary. There is an aggressive criminalization of the poor, while the ruling elites have virtual immunity, protected by high-priced lawyers and non-enforcement or rewriting of laws. Amid selective enforcement of laws in the ruleless society, the high rollers on Wall Street and in wealthy enclaves are not prosecuted, for example, for possessing and ingesting illegal drugs, but the poor are thrown into prison and must forfeit all their property for being caught with small amounts of the same drugs. I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and I am sure there are as many drugs and probably of better quality in Princeton than there are in Trenton. But police in Kevlar vests, armed with long-barreled weapons, are not kicking in Princeton doors at 2 a.m. to terrorize families for a nonviolent drug warrant. HSBC, the world's seventh largest bank by total assets, after admitting to laundering $800 million for Central and South American drug cartels, was slapped with symbolic fines and a deferred prosecution agreement, which is the legal equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card. The poor, meanwhile, are hounded, arrested, and fined for absurdly criminalized activities such as not mowing their lawns, loitering, selling loose cigarettes, although Eric Garner was not, at the time he was murdered, selling loose cigarettes, carrying open containers of alcohol, or, this is my favorite, and it's real, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which means standing on a sidewalk. These fines are used to fill state and county budget shortfalls resulting from corporations and the wealthy fixing the rules to avoid paying meaningful taxes, if they pay taxes at all.
And here we must pause part one of Chris Hedges' talk, America, the Farewell Tour. We'll hear the rest next week. The audio comes from a video posted online by Joe Friendly. The audio was re-engineered by Welton Vaught, host of the podcast Other Voices, Other Choices. Thanks once again to Welton. You can find more of Welton's work on his YouTube channel and also at his website, othervoicesotherchoices.blogspot.com. You will recognize that address as just around the corner from our own website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. If you would like to rehear any installment of our show, you can find a copy at our website. Once again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our makeup consultant, Governor Ralph Northam, on behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up Call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
There's really big news to report today concerning 9/11. As you may remember, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, which formed roughly in 2016, submitted a grand jury petition to a federal court in New York City in April of 2018, which was asking for a grand jury investigation into certain aspects of 9/11, and provided the court with evidence to support their request. And this past November, the Lawyers Committee received a response indicating that the court would proceed with a grand jury investigation in this case. Now, grand juries are done in secret, so we'll see what happens. The Lawyers Committee are hoping to be included in the grand jury proceedings, but they don't have to be invited. And we're well aware of how good our government is at cover-ups, so we'll see what happens. But it is a good step forward. It is good news, so we'll see where it goes. So to start the show today, you'll hear actor and political activist Ed Asner, a longtime advocate for 9/11 truth, talking about the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, of which he was a board member and has recently become its executive director. That will be followed by architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, who has worked with the Lawyers Committee extensively on the evidence, and Barbara Honegger, author, journalist, and producer of the video about the Pentagon called Behind the Smoke Curtain, and a board member of the Lawyers Committee, talking to you about this great news. So let's begin with this clip by Ed Asner.
I have important news of a promising development in the area of law and justice, and I need your help. But first, here's some background. In recent generations, very serious crimes and political scandals have occurred which have tested our judicial and law enforcement systems. Such crimes have rocked the world and have tested our values and our democracy. The United States Constitution has been a model and an inspiration for the world. It has provided noble principles which have guided and unified us for 200 years. As we've been reminded by many of our nation's leaders over the years, constant vigilance by us, the citizens of the United States, is required to protect this Constitution and our democracy. To ensure that our legal institutions operate with integrity, we need attorneys and judges to uphold the highest of legal standards. But even that is not enough. An engaged citizenry is more than just desirable. It is essential, especially in these times. But when the separate branches of government refuse to hold the others accountable, that job falls to the ultimate authority in a democracy, the people themselves. Among the most disturbing of the crimes that have tested our democracy are the horrific attacks of 9/11. 9/11 not only raised fears for our nation's safety, but has been the motivation for multiple wars with an enormous cost in human lives, with trillions of dollars spent and with no end in sight. The war on terror has been described as an endless war in which the enemy cannot even be clearly identified, let alone defeated. At the core of the war on terror is the official narrative about 9/11. The aftermath of 9/11 has brought us not only an endless string of wars, but also an unprecedented government intrusion into our privacy. As a result of 9/11, we have been living an Orwellian nightmare. Our democratic form of government and the critical checks and balances against abuse of power provided in our Constitution are at risk like never before. One would think our leaders would make every effort to solve the crimes of 9/11. But rather than enduring a full and independent investigation and adjudication of the crimes of 9/11, The official investigation has been described by astute observers as a highly orchestrated whitewash. Even commissioners who served in the official investigation complained of major roadblocks and limitations imposed on them. In plain language, there was a cover-up. Further, I'm sure you know that a necessary part of solving a crime is to examine the forensic evidence. But I bet some of you may not know that over the last 15 years, professionals in the fields of science, architecture, and engineering have accumulated a large body of forensic evidence about the crimes of 9/11 that our government has yet to acknowledge, let alone evaluate. The families of the victims and we, the American people, deserve to have this evidence examined independently and thoroughly. Let's face it, nearly 15 years have gone by, and the essential truth of 9/11 remains untold. The call for justice remains unanswered. This is why I'm here, to introduce the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, a nonprofit organization which has been formed to address this exact problem. After 2 years of analysis, strategizing, and planning, the Lawyers Committee is ready to implement a carefully planned strategy to achieve the goals of transparency and accountability for the crime of 9/11. To achieve these important goals, the Lawyers Committee has committed itself to performing a thorough and independent investigation, preparing and filing a petition for a federal grand jury, and pursuing civil lawsuits, including lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act. Why is this so important now? Because this may be one of our last opportunities to expose the falsehoods of the official 9/11 narrative that has cost us so much in money, lives, international respect and prestige, and our constitutional rights. Just as important, this is our best chance to investigate and expose the private and illegal agenda behind the ongoing global war on terror, which began as a result of 9/11. The encouraging news is, with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, we now have a team of experienced lawyers dedicated to pick up where previous investigations left off and do the work that I expect will have truly historic consequences. I'm pleased to announce that I proudly agreed to serve on this board of directors. The Lawyers Committee's attorneys, researchers, and investigators have been donating their time. The new executive director is donating 12 months of his time. Now, what's required is your support right now.
And they do need our support. So go to their website and learn how you can help with this amazing new grand jury investigation. And here's Ed Asner giving you that web address.
It's lcfor911.org.
And now you'll hear from architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Barbara Honegger, a member of the board for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, discussing this new grand jury investigation into 9/11. This conversation was from an interview with Josh Sigurdin of WAM, or World Alternative Media, and has been edited for time constraints. They're responding to Josh's question concerning their thoughts on this latest amazing news about the grand jury petition. It begins with Barbara Honegger, and here she is.
It's the petition of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. And I need to say up front that we have a rule in the Lawyers Committee, I'm on the board of the Lawyers Committee, that to make any official statement on behalf of the Lawyers Committee per se, there need to be two of the attorneys from the board on the radio or television program. Mm-hmm. So I'm speaking as a private citizen, but of course I'm knowledgeable because I am on the board. So with that upfront statement, let me answer your question. So the bottom line is, people, we have had an historic breakthrough for 9/11 Truth and Justice. On November 7th, so it was a little bit ago now, and I can explain if you're interested why it took a while to get the information out to the public, which we did in the last few days. But about 3 days ago, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry announced in official press releases, the Lawyers Committee announced that on November 7th, the Lawyers Committee received an official letter from the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. That's the federal courthouse in Manhattan that has the jurisdiction for the World Trade Center events on 9/11. And we received a letter saying, to our shock and pleasant surprise, that the U.S. Attorney would be doing as we demanded, which is to follow the law. And he cited the federal statute that they're going to follow, and that federal statute explicitly in its text requires them, and they said they would do it, to submit our grand jury petition, which is online on the Lawyers Committee website for the world to read, www.lcfor911.org, that they will be submitting our petition and the 57 evidentiary exhibits proving that the official story of what brought down World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 on 9/11, the latter not hit by any plane whatsoever and came down in a classic controlled demolition, will be submitted to a specially convened special criminal grand jury. This is historic.
And now Barbara is asked if this grand jury investigation creates a clear path forward for the 9/11 truth movement.
Well, yes. The petition is the beginning, of course, of that clear path forward. People need to understand that this is an official action. We have moved from 9/11 forensic evidence and facts to 9/11 justice. And one of the most exciting pieces of news is that I drafted, on behalf of the Lawyers Committee, press release, 400-word press release that was put out 2 days ago in the morning, 8:30 a.m. East Coast time, by PR Newswire. And it went to all of the entire U.S. One market, which means as many as 8.5 million readers and viewers. And it's already been picked up by over 165 mainstream newspapers like the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and mainstream radio and mainstream television. And they have reposted it on their websites verbatim, including the embedded links to our petition, to our evidentiary exhibits, and to the U.S. Attorney's letter. This is official action, and they are covering it in the mainstream media.
And now here's architect Richard Gage.
Yeah, the Lawyers Committee has been doing exceptional work. They've been with us step by step, and now they're launching forward. And maybe we were carrying the burden, you know, from 2006 and 7, and then the Lawyers Committee got formed in the last several years. Of course, our petition calls for a real, unimpeachable 9/11 investigation, specifically regarding the destruction of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers. So this is music to our ears, almost unbelievable. It's a little hard to fathom it, but we're crossing our fingers and we're backing the Lawyers Committee 100%. And of course, the evidence that we've compiled over the last 12 years is getting packaged and is going to be ready to go to help this poor grand jury panel, which is going to be besieged from left and right, I'm sure.
And now they're asked, isn't this a case of the government investigating itself? And what can we expect from this grand jury investigation?
Well, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Southern Manhattan District. We don't know who is the grand jury, the members of them. There are significant examples, and Barbara can cite these, of grand juries who have done right despite the efforts to constrict their scope of review. What we know is we're going to be presenting them, and Barbara can address this too, hopefully directly, packages of evidence that are absolutely irrefutable for the explosive demolition of all three of these World Trade Center skyscrapers.
And now here's Barbara's response.
I think people need to know that the evidence is incontrovertible and that evidence is explicitly detailed and referenced with the evidentiary exhibits themselves. And we're talking about formal studies results. We're talking about academic peer-reviewed papers. We're talking about videos of the eyewitnesses. These are all amongst the 57 pieces of evidentiary information that are part of the petition. They are an official part of our grand jury petition that is going to be, they said so in the letter, they are going to be following the law. The law is very clear that all of the information that we have provided, they said in the letter they reviewed it. Let's realize the letter was signed by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and that was a typed signature. And under that, it was actually signed, like a signature, by the Assistant U.S. Attorney for Counterterrorism and Terrorism. They have read every word of this. We have educated the U.S. Attorney and the top Assistant U.S. Attorney in Manhattan on the truth. They have just been enlightened. They're human beings. That's their town. That's their city. And they are going to be giving it to between, I think it's 18 and 23 concerned citizens, almost certainly in that city. They care about their city and they're going to care about the truth. And they will be given it and they will read it. It's the evidence that turns people around. That what you've been fighting against all these years is people who refuse to look at the evidence mostly.
And here Barbara's asked about the possibility of government whistleblowers coming forward due to this grand jury investigation.
Well, that's already happened. Look at Sybil Edmonds. We have the grand jury petitions, evidentiary exhibits, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. But we chose, of course, the ones that we thought were the best to include that, you know, hit you between the eyes like a 2x4. You can't question them. And in amongst the 57 evidentiary exhibits, which are part of the petition, there are statements and evidence from whistleblowers, unbelievable whistleblowers from over 100 first responders, firemen, in their official statements to the fire department in New York City. There's no question once you look, and these 18 to 23 ordinary, probably New York citizens are going to see the truth. And when they see the truth, yes, I think there's more than hope. And do I think people will come out? Yes, now that it's known and it's being put out by the mainstream media, and it's growing every day, by the way, in response to our PR Newswire release just 2 days ago. This is now official news. We have a link in our press release to the actual U.S. Attorney's letter. It says it all.
And here Barbara's asked how this investigation will be different than the whole Kennedy assassination investigations.
Well, with the Kennedy assassination, we had the Zapruder film, which didn't come out for years. With 9/11, we've got how many, Richard? I think it was 82 videos of the World Trade Center collapses. I mean,
well, yeah. And we have the peer-reviewed paper from the team of 8 international scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen, which is 25 pages of irrefutable evidence that there's nanothermite chips found in all the World Trade Center samples. It should not be there. This has to be acknowledged. It's been denied but and kind of wished away by a lot of people for a long time. But here it is in the hands of jurors and, as Barbara mentioned, 165 mainstream media outlets. So something's going to happen here. People are going to be looking at this petition. They're going to be seeing this evidence, which includes the U.S. Geological Survey finding billions and billions of previously molten iron microspheres in all the World Trade Center dust samples, amounting to 10 tons of what can only be the residue of ignited thermite, which should not be there either. They have no
Talk
other...
Talk about a smoking gun. That's a thermite. It's the smoking gun.
Yeah, and people are going to be educated about the third tower, which we also call the smoking gun, World Trade Center Building 7, a 47-story skyscraper that on the afternoon of 9/11, after multiple witnesses hear explosions, drops like a rock straight down uniformly, symmetrically into its own footprint in under 7 seconds, just like a controlled demolition. Whoa.
Next, Richard is asked about a Fox News host who said that World Trade Center 7 didn't come down due to controlled demolition, but was brought down because it was on a landfill, which was very shaky ground.
It is absurd, and it's the first time I've ever heard that point. These buildings were built on bedrock. Their foundations go all the way down, in the case of the Twin Towers, 7 stories through a basement to solid ground. And even NIST, the agency that was tasked by Congress to determine how and why these 3 buildings collapsed, NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, they even say that the buildings were robust. that there was no problem with the shaking of their foundations, and there's no problem with the shaking of the foundation of Building 7 when the Twin Towers came down either. We can refute Fox News just by the official story itself from NIST.
Right, and also it's extremely important, and the grand jury is going to learn this very quickly as well, that the towers were actually designed and constructed by the architects and built to specifically and explicitly withstand the impact of the kinds of planes that hit them on 9/11.
The biggest planes at the time they had, which was 707s, but they traveled faster, so they had the same kinetic energy. In fact, John Skilling, who's the mentor of Leslie Robertson, said it could stand the two planes hitting it. But the problem would be that the fuel would dump into the building, but the building would still be there. It's designed to withstand even jet fuel fires.
Yeah.
And next, Barbara is answering a question about how she got into the 9/11 truth movement.
Believe it or not, at the time of, well, before 9/11, beginning in 1995, and for another 11 years after 9/11, so for over a decade and a half, I was the senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School here in the Monterey Peninsula of California, Central California coast, where I live. And the Naval Postgraduate School, also known as NPS, where I was the senior military journalist for all that time, is built by DOD itself, by the Department of Defense, as the Pentagon's premier science, technology, and national security affairs graduate research university. So I was a senior military affairs journalist there for over a decade and a half, for 16 years. And it was in that capacity, on the morning of 9/11, that I was not allowed in the gate. This is a military base, even though it's a military university. I was not allowed into the gate. And because I was not considered like just the very top people, the admiral and a few under him, as so-called essential personnel. And so I got to go home and watch television. And just like the event that triggered my research that resulted in my book, October Surprise, that on the true story behind the Iran side of Iran-Contra, which came out a long time ago in 1989 in May, the research for that book was triggered by a single event, which was President Reagan and Vice President George Bush putting their hands up to take the oath of office on January 20th, 1981, and the hostages in Iran, the 52 hostages being released instantly thereafter. I knew I smelled a huge rat, and it didn't take too long for me to pull together a 76-page detailed reference timeline that formed the basis of my book, October Surprise. The same kind of thing happened on 9/11. I drove the few miles to my mother's home in Carmel, turned on the television, walked in. My brother happened to be there. And I said, you know, we're at war. And they said, what? And I said, turn on the television. And they didn't even have it on. They were talking about carpet samples. And they turned on the television and we watched the first tower, the South Tower, fall. And of course, there were repeats of what had happened just before that, both of the plane impacts. And they played those ad nauseum on the television. I believe I was watching ABC that morning, and instantly, just like with the taking of the oath of office and the hostages were released, I smell a rat. And from day one, in my official position, talk about somebody from in the government who's talking, that first person inside the government was me. And I never stopped. I've never stopped. And the miracle is they let me stay in my official position as that senior military affairs journalist for that top DOD university in the entire country for 11 years until I retired. And through those entire years, as Richard knows well, I was in the public space and in the government space, even though I held that job and they didn't touch me.
And here Barbara is responding to a question about the time frame for these grand jury proceedings.
Well, we don't know. But grand juries, as I recall, I should say that the law requires the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York to convene a special criminal grand jury for this specific purpose, not just take an existing, sitting, already convened criminal grand jury. So that's a process that takes time. You have to go through the voting rolls or the DMV rolls, and you have to bring in many, many more potential jurors, and you have to vet those jurors. It's a long process. It's supposed to be randomly selected. So that takes time. And then, as I understand it, criminal grand juries especially are usually convened for a pre-specified period of time. It can be a year. It can be 18 months. And now people need to understand that grand juries are secret. They do not have to tell us anything about what's happening, besides letting us know that they're going to do it, which they did in the U.S. Attorney's letter that we received on November. It was dated November 7th. We actually didn't receive it for quite a while after that, and there's a story behind that, but it's unimportant. And when we finally did receive it, and it was open, by the way, some coffee spilled on the letter, which we had to clean up electronically to put it on the web. But it takes time. I would say probably a year and a half. But the good news is that I can't tell you what they are. But our attorneys on the Lawyers Committee Board are very, very smart. And they have been fighting the government, whistleblower attorneys, for a very long time. And we have backup plans, believe me.
And now Richard is responding to a question about why people should question the events of 9/11.
Well, we have a whole lot of evidence. Barb mentioned 57 separate points of evidence. Starting with Building 7, we have the irrefutable evidence of the controlled demolition of that building, the fact that it came down symmetrically, the fact that it came down at free fall, the fact that it came down in under 7 seconds, all indicates that all 82 columns had to have been removed simultaneously. Guess what? The official cause of that building's failure is normal office fires. Well, normal office fires have never brought down a skyscraper before 9/11. And so all of a sudden, it does exactly what a controlled demolition does. In addition, there's evidence in the dust, as we've already discussed, the molten iron microspheres, you know, the diameter of a human hair, billions of them, 10 tons of them, unexplained in the official story. The presence of nanothermite chips, again, up to 10 tons of these materials by extrapolation are found and documented in a peer-reviewed paper. As Barbara mentioned, we have the hundreds, actually now, of witnesses of explosions occurring before there was any descent of the top portion of either of the twin towers. We have the laterally freely flying structural steel sections weighing 4 tons, laterally ejected 60 miles an hour, some of them 80 miles an hour, landing up to 600 feet in every direction. That's the energy of a 200-pound cannonball shot 3 miles. And there's thousands of these, such that there's no pile at the bottom of either tower. So we have the lack of concrete floors as well, 110 of them, each an acre in size in each of the twin towers. But there's no stack of them found at the bottom of either pile, just a 3-4-story pile. Where's the concrete? It's pulverized in midair and spread in a 4-inch thick blanket over lower Manhattan, 3 square miles. So this kind of evidence goes on and on and on, and I would refer people to the YouTube video, which we've put up called 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. Just search Experts Speak Out on YouTube. You'll see all this evidence from 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts. It's all there for everybody to see.
If I may add to that on the one point of evidence, the one that really grabs me in addition to everything that Richard just said, and especially World Trade Center 7, which architects and engineers in our movement calls the smoking gun, there is another smoking gun, and it is featured in the grand jury petition and the evidentiary exhibits, including videos of the whistleblowers who experienced it themselves, and there are at least 2 dozen of them. And that is the fact that very few people know that we have official seismic evidence and we have expert analysis showing that of the analysis of that official seismic evidence of the seismic record of what happened at both World Trade Center towers in New York on 9/11, that there was a massive explosion in the deep basement of the first tower, World Trade Center 1, 14 seconds before the plane hit, not after. And for World Trade Center 2, there was a massive deep basement explosion in the deep basement of World Trade Center 2, 17 seconds before the plane hit that tower. Mm-hmm.
And here they're discussing the consequences of 9/11, and in this case, it's the 9/11 wars.
And those wars are still going on. The 9/11 wars are still going on, and they're trying to take it to Iran.
And here's Barbara Honegger's final comment about the grand jury proceedings.
The legal rubber has just met the road.
And thanks again to Josh Sigurdin, of World Alternative Media for providing that interview. And here's Ed Asner again to tell you how to reach the Lawyers Committee's website.
www.lcfor911.org. That's lcfor911.org.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mamie Rosenberg.
No to U.S. orchestrated coup in Venezuela. No to Trump imbuing himself with the power to decide the leader of a sovereign country.
Hey, where the heck are the Democrats? We're going to speak now with Mark Weisbrot, co-director with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he's the president of Just Foreign Policy, a non-governmental organization dedicated to reforming the United States foreign policy. And Kevin Zeese, a lawyer, political activist who's worked on a wide range of issues, beginning with ending the war on drugs and mass incarceration, including helping to organize the 2011 Occupy encampment in Washington, D.C. at Freedom Plaza. And he currently serves as co-director of Popular Resistance. And I can't think of any two more knowledgeable people to bring with us at this frightening time where I am conjuring up Guatemala coups, Chilean coups, what happened in with the oligarchs and fascism in Paraguay and Uruguay, and on and on. And help us understand how it has been so easy in some ways for the BBC, the New York Times, to launch a full court press in support of regime change in Venezuela. What is it that our public does not understand and needs to? Take us into the midst of U.S. interventionism in Latin America. And it's hard to know which one of you to start with. Let's toss a coin. I'm going to say start with Mark Weisbrot. And Kevin, Mark, please, the two of you are the experts in this. Feel free to interchange.
Hi, thank you. And thanks for having me here. Just to respond to one thing you said about the Democrats, it's true. There haven't been a lot. And there's been some Democrats who have said bad things. But on the other hand, you have a handful that have been pretty good in Congress. You have Ro Khanna from California, who actually challenged Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, who was supporting the regime change effort. And he said very specifically the U.S. should not anoint the leader of the opposition in Venezuela during an internal polarized conflict. Tulsi Gabbard, Ilhan Omar was very strong. Barbara Lee, Bernie Sanders all had statements against what the Trump administration is trying to do. So that's a start, at least, and I think it will grow, actually. I think that there is some potential for that. But overall, obviously, this is a terrible thing that's going on in the media. The vast majority of the media doesn't even give you enough information to make up your own mind about it. It is a kind of a classical regime change effort. The United States government has been trying to overthrow this government for 17 years now. They were involved in the coup in 2002. You almost never see that in the press, but the hard evidence is actually there. You have a State Department document that says that the United States actually provided training and other support to the people who were involved in that coup. You have CIA documents that were declassified showing that they knew about the coup in advance, and yet when the coup happened, the White House at the time, George W. Bush, said that Chavez had resigned, even though they knew that, in fact, exactly what was going on. So they tried to help the coup succeed. And then, of course, they stepped up funding from there on to the opposition, invested hundreds of millions of dollars that we know about in trying to destabilize and overthrow the government all the way to today. So this is the culmination of a long series of efforts. And it's, you know, regardless of what you think of the current government or anybody thinks of the current government of Venezuela, this is going to make things worse. In fact, the decision that the Trump administration just made, which is to recognize a president, or what they're calling a president, he's actually a member of the Venezuelan Congress, and they called him, Pence called him the night before to arrange that he would declare himself president the next day, which he did. And one of the impacts of this is that if they continue on this path, the government won't be able to sell its oil on international markets. Now, the financial embargo that the United States has on Venezuela right now doesn't prevent them from selling their oil. They've threatened to take that step several times, but they haven't been able to because of the oil interests in the United States, who refine Venezuelan oil and would lose a lot of money. So this is a backdoor way of accomplishing an actual trade embargo, because what happens is, since this new president, Juan Guaido, the congressman, since he's now in charge of the country, according to them, and according to the allies that they have, which include right-wing governments in Latin America, and we can talk about this more, some of the larger countries in Europe, which is most of Venezuela's trading partners where they sell their oil, they won't be able to get the revenue for this oil. So, for example, if you look at Francisco Rodriguez, he's an opposition activist and a Wall Street economist who's the leading expert on the Venezuelan economy. He's estimated that this would cause the economy to shrink by 26% this year, which is, you know, it's like our Great Depression, only in 1 year. And that is because they can't sell their oil. And, of course, a lot of people would die as a result of this, as they're already dying from the current sanctions because they can't get access to medicines. So this is a very devastating thing that they're doing. And, of course, if they say they're trying to resolve anything there, they're going to make all the problems worse, including the refugees. 3 million people have left the country and are all over Latin America and Europe and everywhere else.
And we're speaking with Mark Weisbrot, who he's speaking to us now, and we want to bring Kevin Zeese into the discussion as well. Kevin?
Yeah, you asked, you know, why was it so easy for all this Western media, BBC, et cetera, to come on board? It's because this has been planned for a while. Like Mark said, this has been going on for, you know, since Chavez was elected. In fact, Elliot Abrams, who Donald Trump appointed to his team this last weekend, okayed the 2002 coup against Chavez and was also involved in the Iran-Contras, was convicted of Iran-Contra crimes and Guatemala massacres, and so now he's in charge of the Venezuela transition. But the reason why this is so easy is because it's been worked on for months. Trump has made Venezuela a priority. He's focused on it consistently, and there have been numerous attempts at coups, assassinations, and regime change throughout, lots of threats of military activity. In the last couple of months, they focused on this coup attempt. So they had, when this attempt happened, they had it all lined up. You could see the social media was ready to roll. You could see the corporate media was ready to roll. You could see the U.S. allies, the right-wing governments in Latin America and the European governments came on board very quickly. Trump recognized the coup president within minutes of him announcing he was president. So this was a planned operation. Now, it's a failed operation also already. I mean, it's obvious they miscalculated. Trump thought that the military was more divided than they are. The military has said multiple times since this coup president appointed himself that they're staying with Maduro. And Russia has said to the United States, stay out of Venezuela. And Russia already has a battalion of troops there. They had a battalion of troops there last year. They were thinking about doubling it last year because of these threats that were being made even before this coup. And what's interesting about the oil issue that Mark pointed out is China has loaned Venezuela $50 billion. And part of that is to become a partner in their oil industry. So if the U.S. goes to blockade or put an embargo on that oil industry, they are blockading China as well. So you got China and Russia involved in Venezuela. This is becoming a global geopolitical conflict. If Trump thought he would have an easy victory here to, you know, show his great leadership, he's going to be wrong about that. Then I was in Venezuela for the election last year, and my impression of the revolution there, the Bolivarian process there, is that it is broad and deep, and the people will not succumb to U.S. imperialism. Whatever complaints they have about Maduro, and there are people who think Maduro has not gone far enough as far as socialism goes, think he's gone too far, have criticisms of him, they all unite around Maduro when something like this happens. And so you're dealing with a unified population of at least 30% of the public that solidly supports the Chavistas. He won 67% of the vote in the last election. It was a legitimate election. Venezuela runs really excellent elections. Jimmy Carter said they were the best electoral system in the world. And when I saw it operating, I'd agree with him. It's much better than the electoral system in the United States. There's no way there's fraud in those elections. Now, the opposition tried to undermine the elections because they knew they were going to lose. They tried to undermine the elections by boycotting them. But even with that boycott, 46% voted, 67% for Maduro. The next challenger was at 20%. He was the lead opposition candidate. So Maduro won that election, is the legitimate president, and this nonsense that he's a dictator and that Guaido is the real president does not stand up under any analysis of the law internationally as well as the law under the Constitution of Venezuela. So this is a bizarre coup. It's a very open coup. I mean, and back in 2002, U.S. tried to hide their involvement. In this one, Pence put a video out the day before, in addition to calling Guaido and saying they would support him. And of course, then Trump had everything lined up to recognize him and move forward. So this is an open coup, and it's already a coup that's struggling. They'll keep trying. Today, the United States sees $7 billion in oil assets as a new economic sanction against Venezuela. So they're not giving up. But I tell you, the people of Venezuela will not give up either.
Mark?
Well, I think that they are doing a lot of things. I mean, the U.S. government is doing more. You know, first of all, I think most people don't realize how bad the sanctions have been.
That's right.
And if you look at, for example, they went into effect in August of 2017, the financial embargo. And that basically prevented the government from borrowing, from getting a lot of other credits that even weren't covered by the sanctions because most financial institutions are conservative and they don't want to take a chance of running into trouble with U.S. Treasury and getting billion-dollar fines, as others have gotten. European banks, for example, have gotten billion-dollar fines for violating sanctions against North Korea or Iran or Cuba. And so it cuts off a lot of credit, and oil production really collapsed since the sanctions in August of 2017. They've probably lost about $6 billion in revenue. Now, if you think about that, when they had a lot of money, they were spending maybe $2 billion a year on pharmaceuticals. And so that just means that, you know, millions of people can't get pharmaceuticals and life-saving drugs in a lot of cases. And, of course, they didn't, I mean, the financial embargo didn't create the mess. And this is true, and I think we have to acknowledge that the government had some economic policies that failed quite miserably. And it's not socialism or whatever you see in the media, because it wasn't a socialist economy anyway. It was overwhelmingly privately owned. And even under Chavez, the vast majority of jobs that were created, and millions of jobs were created during the growth period before 2014, when they went into recession, they were created in the private sector. But they did make some serious macroeconomic mistakes, primarily the exchange rate. They had this fixed overvalued exchange rate, and they kept it even as they developed inflation that fed back into a black market exchange rate, which kept depreciating their currency, which then fed back into inflation, and they got into this spiral, which really started in the fall of 2012, and they rode it all the way to the hyperinflation that you see today. What the sanctions really do is make the situation considerably worse, and they also are designed to prevent the government from getting out of the five-year depression in which they've lost about half of their economy, about half of their GDP, which has never happened before in Latin American history. So it's a very deep depression. It's hyperinflation, inflation at over 1,000,000% a month, a year, I mean, and they can't get out of it with the financial sanctions that the U.S. has imposed. And that's because the U.S. really wants to, they want regime change. They don't want a negotiated solution. They want to put their people there when everything collapses. And that's the part you also don't see in the media. The media has for years now pretended that the U.S. government is simply trying to pressure the Maduro government to do this or that thing. It changes from month to month. It could be now, you know, they want them to call new elections. Before, it was, you know, something else. And they always try to look at it, to present it as some kind of pressure. But if you actually follow what's going on, you can see that they simply want to overthrow the government. There's nothing that Maduro could have done at any time to get relief from the sanctions.
That's exactly right. I would just add to that, Mark, that Venezuela's rejected U.S. empire. It's allied with the opponents of U.S. empire. And that is part of this process. And the reality of Venezuela's economy is the problems really go back way before. I mean, go back to when oil was discovered in Venezuela, and it became the dominant economic force that made it cheaper to buy food rather than grow it, or cheaper to buy cars rather than build them. The Dutch disease, you may have heard of the Dutch disease, which when a country has a natural resource, makes it very that creates all sorts of challenges in their finance system. With influx of foreign dollars, it makes it very hard for domestic economy, other aspects of the domestic economy, to grow. Venezuela tried to change that with Chavez and Maduro. They created all sorts of new efforts to broaden the economy, but the crash of the oil industry, the price being cut in more than half a few years ago, combined with the sanctions, was a 1-2 punch that is very hard to overcome. And the third punch was the business interests in Venezuela on the inside trying to sabotage the economy. They would hide essential goods in warehouses. They would sell food that's for Venezuela in Colombia. And Colombia or Venezuela would try to buy, for example, medicine. If they had the money, they'd try to buy it. They would be stopped from buying it because of the economic blockade. But they were told by countries that, we can provide you with humanitarian assistance. Of course, the catch to humanitarian assistance is that gives the OAS the excuse to intervene because of the humanitarian catastrophe that requires intervention. So Venezuela, the government, I don't know how a government like that can function when you have the oligarchs in your country undermining it by sabotage, when you have U.S., the biggest economy in the world, blockading it, working with Western European countries and allies in the region, and then you have the crash in the oil economy, which is the basis for their economy. That's a really tough group to handle. But even with that, last year Venezuela announced they had built 4 million homes. That's enough for 8 to 10 million people out of a population of 30 million. So even with that depression, that collapse, they still focused on the poor and built 4 million new homes. And that's, you know, for almost one-third the population. That's kind of incredible. Think about what we do in Puerto Rico in comparison. But it's a very challenging situation. Maduro deserves some blame, but he's also in a very difficult struggle against very hard tides against him.
Mark, a number of countries immediately lined up against Maduro after the legislature tried to take power. But the OAS, the Organization of American States, recently has supported Maduro. Do you think that has much of an impact?
Well, it's a little bit. Yeah, I think it's noticed. It's really heroic, these small Caribbean countries like St. Vincent and Grenadines, a bunch of them, they're the ones that swing the vote in the OAS, and it shows really how cowardly some of these other countries are, like the Europeans especially, that went along with Trump, because they were able to stand up. I mean, Haiti gave in because Rubio, first of all, it's a government that's kind of close to the U.S., and secondly, they weren't even going to go for it. They didn't the last vote they had in the OAS, and Rubio threatened them outright, and they had a lot of threats to these countries if they didn't go along with them in the OAS. But, you know, this is a kind of an important thing, a question that you raised, because, you know, the media narrative is kind of overwhelming. And so, and then this is really serious. You know, like, you compare it to the Iraq War, where before the war started, at least.
And I just have to interrupt you to say we have 30 seconds, but I know you can rise to the task.
Yeah. All right. The 30-second answer is, when you see this European support for Trump is a little misleading. It's all because Pedro Sanchez, who's the prime minister of Spain, switched sides and went with Trump, and Germany and some of the others follow the Spanish lead on Latin America. And so that's really what's going on there. And it's not this class of civilizations that the media presents it as, you know, where you have China, Russia, and Turkey on one side and all the so-called democracies on the other. That's what they're trying to convince people.
Well, you know what you need to do, Kevin Zeese?
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, nope, I wish we had time, but I just want them to read your articles, Mark Weisbrot.
Well, I was going to suggest.
Go ahead. You got 10 seconds.
You go to popularresistance.org and look at our most recent newsletter. Our most recent newsletter goes through a lot of everything activists need to know about this coup is that newsletter, popularresistance.org. Check it out. We only scratched the surface here.
And Mark Weisbrot, where can people read your work?
CEPR.net.
And believe me, the articles are great, and we're going to continue to talk about this because no to U.S. orchestrated coup in Venezuela, no to Trump imbuing himself with the power to decide the leader of a sovereign country. And regime change, maybe in the U.S. That's about it. Speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Kevin Zeese, who is with Popular Resistance. And that is what we need. Thanks for listening. Stay calm, thoughtful, but agitate, organize, create that people's empowerment.
Come, you masters of war, that build all the guns, you that build the death planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. We just want you to know we can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but built to destroy. Turn and run further when the fast bullets fly. Come, you master.
Seize the revolutionary time. Oh, seize the revolutionary time. Seize the revolutionary time. Seize the revolutionary time. Seize the revolutionary time.
Not just the name of this jam.
Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say.
You fasten the trigger.
Has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
The research coming out of North America, that's both in the United States and also in Canada, of the Native American people and the First Nations people of Canada, is there are high suicide rates within the LGBTI community. 56% have attempted suicide. So when we use that information based on our shared histories over here in Australia...
Connect the dots. This is what happens.
We can have the mantra that we treat everybody the same, but in reality, in order to treat people equally, we need to treat people differently.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Greek Orthodox bishop is convicted of homophobic hate speech. Page turns on Pence after the Smollett hate attack. And Australia's Black Rainbow opens doors for queer Indigenous youth. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 2nd, 2019. In an unusual secular rebuke of a leading religious figure, a Greek Orthodox Church bishop was sentenced on January 28th to 7 months in jail for inciting homophobic hatred and abusing his clerical position. Bishop Ambrosios of Kalavrita was among the most vocal clerics to speak out against a proposed civil unions bill being debated in December 2015 when he called LGBTQ people the dregs of society in a written address published on his blog. Spit on them, he told his followers. Vote against them. They are not human. They are freaks of nature, mentally and spiritually sick. They are mentally insane. Don't hesitate then. Wherever you see them, spit on them. Don't leave them in peace. They are dangerous. Nevertheless, the civil unions bill passed in Parliament on December 22nd of that year. The three-member misdemeanor court in the town of Asio, who found the 79-year-old cleric guilty this week, suspended the sentence. One analyst thought that the court didn't want to further antagonize officials of the politically powerful Greek Orthodox Church. In addition, the bishop would probably be foolhardy to repeat the offense, as judges are likely to see that as him spitting on them. Bishop Ambrosios is the first Greek Orthodox Church official to ever be tried in a secular court, thanks to the complaint brought by nine queer activists who cited Article 196 of the Greek Penal Code, outlawing the abuse of ecclesiastical office.
Activists in the Russian city of St. Petersburg have filed a formal complaint demanding an official investigation into the widely reported detention and abuse of people perceived to be LGBTQ in the country's semi-autonomous, mostly Muslim region of Chechnya. In a statement it submitted to the Investigative Committee of Russia, the country's version of what in the U.S. would be called the FBI, the Russian LGBT network submitted detailed accounts of the detention of 14 people, including torture and at least one murder. The formal complaint is said to be prompted by reports of a renewed purge of queer people in the region that began at the end of December. Chechen dictator Ramzan Kadyrov has consistently denied the charges, and Russian leader Vladimir Putin has said that an investigation that he authorized found no evidence to support the claims. The Russian LGBT network said that more than 40 people have been detained in the latest roundup, including women as well as men perceived to be queer, and that at least two have died during torture. Spokesman Igor Kochetkov, who says he himself has received death threats, told reporters that the 14 cases cited in their complaint accounted for just the people held in one police station in the Chechen capital city, Grozny, and that many more are being held in what amounts to concentration camps elsewhere in the region. The activist group blames Russia's federal authorities for the latest crackdown, saying that their failure to intervene when the purge first began in 2017 has given Chechen strongman Ramzan Kadyrov a sense of impunity. A report by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, issued in December before the current wave of detentions began, charged Russia with failing to live up to its responsibilities. The Russian LGBT network has helped at least 150 LGBTQ people leave Chechnya since the purge began in 2017. It says that about 130 of them managed to go abroad. Rainbow Railroad, a Canadian group, has said it's helped more than 55 Chechens immigrate to their country.
catching up on the latest machinations of Donald Trump and his minions to undermine LGBTQ rights in the United States, the Administration for Children and Families, part of the Department of Health and Human Services, waived anti-bias requirements for federally funded foster care agencies in the state of South Carolina on January 23rd. That allows the faith-based agency called Miracle Hill Ministries to reject prospective non-Christian or non-heterosexual applicants. An Obama-era policy prohibited federally funded organizations from discriminating on the basis of religion. Any other faith-based agencies in the Palmetto State now have the green light to follow suit. Miracle Hill Ministries reportedly places about 15% of South Carolina children with foster parents. The formal request for the waiver was made last year by Republican South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster. The ACLU said on Twitter that children who are waiting for loving and supportive homes deserve better than this.
In another report, this one in foreign policy, the Trump administration lobbied against the selection of former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet to be the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Though it's not clear if her leftist politics and strong support for marriage equality during her presidential tenure had anything to do with what became a failed U.S. effort to derail her appointment.
Meanwhile, the New York Times has reported on Donald Trump's meeting in the Roosevelt Room of the White House in late January with a group on the far-right fringes of the Republican Party. They were led by Jenny Thomas, the wife of uber-conservative Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Members of the group reportedly railed against marriage equality, the recognition of transgender identity, and even allowing women to serve in the U.S. military during the hour-long meet and greet. Of Jenny Thomas's participation, The Times noted that her activism has raised concerns of conflicts of interest for her husband.
And according to the results of a new Quinnipiac University poll, transgender troops are far more popular with the American public than President Donald Trump. The questions were part of a broader national survey by the well-respected polling group on a variety of political issues, including immigration, the economy, and foreign policy. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted most of the injunctions on implementation of the president's proposed transmilitary ban on January 22nd. 70% in the survey, published on January 29th, believe that qualified transgender people should be allowed to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces. The same survey found that only 38% of the respondents said that Donald Trump is doing a good job.
In other news, Chiba has become the latest city in Japan to issue certificates of recognition to same-gender couples. The municipal government announced its decision to issue the civil partnership certificates in August, and the first were issued on January 29th, with Mayor Toshihito Kumagai presiding over the ceremonies of six same-gender couples. Tokyo Shibuya and Setagaya wards in the cities of Sapporo, Fukuoka, Osaka, Iga, Takarazuka, and Naha have also issued certificates to same-gender couples, but they've been mostly symbolic. In Chiba, the certificates provide real rights along with the official recognition, including the right to apply as a couple for public housing and mutual hospital visitation when one of them is seriously ill. The couple must be over the age of 20, not currently married, and be residents of the city or planning to move there. Heterosexual couples in Chiba can also become certified civil partners. Japan's conservative federal government continues to resist even legislative debate on some form of legal recognition for same-gender couples.
Kentucky's Republican governor, Matt Bevin, has filed legal papers demanding that former Rowan County clerk Kim Davis pay the $225,000 in legal fees and court costs incurred by the victorious gay couples who sued her after she refused to issue marriage licenses to them. Davis was among a handful of public officials who defied the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling. In his 2017 ruling, Judge David Bunning ordered the state of Kentucky to reimburse the couples for the cost of their lawsuit against her. Governor Bevin was a vocal supporter of Davis during her cause celeb jailing and trial, calling her an inspiration to the children of America. But he apparently doesn't want the state to put its money where his mouth was. The governor's legal brief passes the buck to Davis, saying that she had an independent and sworn duty to uphold the law as an elected county officer. Davis lost her bid for re-election in November. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio, was scheduled to hear oral arguments in the coming week on who's responsible for the couple's costs.
And finally, about 2,000 people celebrated at the 5th annual Yangon Pride Festival in the biggest city in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, on the last weekend of January. Homosexuality remains a crime in the socially conservative and predominantly Buddhist Southeast Asian nation under a penal code left by British colonists. A crowd-pleasing drag Olympics topped the festival on January 27th.
Contestants ran a stiletto race, swirled hula hoops, and competed in a handbag flinging contest. It was only the second year, however, that the Pride celebration was a public event. One of the organizers told Reuters that, when we started this, people did not really dare to come to this kind of festival. The first three gatherings were held in a private facility. Now you see a lot of young people, he said. Young people are more proud and out and encouraged and empowered.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 2nd, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
There is more overt racism in the gay community than what there is overt homophobia in the Aboriginal community. So that becomes a real struggle for a lot of young people around acceptance.
A suicide prevention group for Australia's queer Indigenous youth adds another colour to the rainbow later in the program. A high-profile hate crime has brought out stars and fans to support its unexpected target. Lucia Chappelle reports.
I was bruised, but my ribs were not cracked.
Okay.
They were not broken.
Okay.
I went to the doctor immediately. Frank Gadsden drove me. I was not hospitalized.
Okay.
Both my doctors in LA and Chicago cleared me to perform, but said to take care, obviously. And above all, I fought the back.
Actor-singer Jesse Smollett came back strong on stage at Los Angeles-famed Troubadour on February 2nd after surviving a vicious hate crime attack 4 days earlier in Chicago. The black gay star of Empire had been assaulted by two as-yet-unidentified men near his home in the wee hours of January 29th. Smollett's Make America Great Again shouting attackers hurled racist and homophobic slurs as they beat him, poured an unknown chemical over him, and tied a noose around his neck. Many Hollywood celebrities led the chorus of outrage. Among them was Ellen Page, who spoke out during an appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and took the blame right to the top.
We have a media that's saying it's a debate whether or not what just happened to Jesse Smollett is a hate crime. It's absurd. This isn't a debate.
I agree.
Sorry, I'm like...
Not at all.
I'm like really fired up tonight, but...
This is how you have to be fired up.
It feels
up.
Impossible to you not feel
to,
this way right now with the president and the vice president, Mike Pence, who like wishes I couldn't be married. Let's just be clear. The vice president of America wishes I didn't have the love with my wife. He wanted to ban that in Indiana. He believes in conversion therapy. He has hurt LGBTQ people so badly as the government of Indiana. And I think the thing we need to know, and I hope my show Gaycation did this, in terms of connecting the dots, in terms of what happened the other day to Jesse. I don't know him personally. I send all of my love. Connect the dots. This is what happens. If you are in a position of power and you hate people and you want to cause suffering to them, you go through the trouble. You spend your career trying to cause suffering. What do you think is going to happen? Kids are going to be abused, and they're going to kill themselves. And people are going to be beaten on the street. I have traveled the world, and I have met the most marginalized people you can meet. I am lucky to have this time and the privilege to say this. This needs to stop.
That was lesbian actress Ellen Page. Chicago police and the FBI are pursuing leads in the assault on Smollett and have released surveillance video of two persons of interest in the case. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Long before they felt the sting.
some wrong line.
According to the 2016 Australian census, about 3% of the total population identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. The British colonization began in 1788, bringing European culture, language, and laws to the continent. The effect was devastating on the First Nations people of Australia. Traditional indigenous societies were broken down as their land was taken from them by colonizers without any formal treaty or other land-sharing arrangements. Limited First Nations land rights settlements have been granted since the 1970s. These days, rates of incarceration and suicide among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander youth remain disturbingly high. Despite the challenges, Aboriginal communities in Australia remain strong and resilient. Initiatives to reach out to LGBTIQ Indigenous youth have been gaining momentum. The proliferation of interconnected digital technology has made it easier for those living in remote areas to contact support services and to realize they are not alone. Black Rainbow is Australia's first and only national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTIQ suicide prevention national advocacy platform and national touchpoint. They support Indigenous LGBTIQ people who are homeless, domestic violence survivors, and those leaving the justice system. Black Rainbow is 100% Indigenous owned and operated. Barry McKay spoke to the founder of Black Rainbow, Damien Bonson, in Canberra at the Canada-Australia Roundtable on Indigenous Health and Wellness in December 2016.
My name's Damien Bonson. My mob are the Manyari people in the Northern Territory, but also from the island of Moorebag in the Torres Strait. I'm the founder of Black Rainbow, a social enterprise in the prevention of Indigenous LGBTI suicide. And this year I was the recipient of the Dr. Yunupingu Award for Human Rights.
In Australia, same-sex attracted and gender-diverse Australians are said to exhibit up to 14 times higher rates of suicide attempts than their heterosexual peers. For Indigenous Australians, deaths by suicide are 1 in 24. International research shows that Indigenous LGBTIQ people are at risk of suicide in the 40 to 45% range. Damien Bonson again.
Looking at the research coming out of North America, that's both in the United States and also in Canada, of the Native American people and the First Nations people of Canada, is there are high suicide rates within the LGBTI community. We're talking about transgender First Nations or Native American people who 56% have attempted suicide. So when we use that information based on our shared histories over here in Australia, we're not really sure who is actually getting through the net here. Recently we had a suicide in Queensland where, in a real unique position, where the young person's sexuality at age 13 was able to be known. So we had an Indigenous teenage boy who was gay who died by suicide. And what that's actually, it's been a catalyst for discussion around, well, what and how are services equipped to respond to the needs of a young teenage Aboriginal gay person or gender diverse person. And that's also that's the both mainstream services, so the Commonwealth services, the everyday services, plus all the Aboriginal services as well. As a young gay Aboriginal person, you can walk into a service and experience homophobia, but it could be culturally validating for you. Or you could go into a service and experience racism, but it could be validating based on your sexuality. So it's looking at how do we grow the capacity of these services to be able to be a front door that young Indigenous LGBTI people can walk through and feel safe about.
So do LGBT youth, Indigenous youth, generally feel accepted by their communities? And if not, why not?
Look, I think so. Not to say that there isn't any sort of homophobia, and which is, I think, is one of the terrible hangovers of colonialism. in Aboriginal communities, when we look at difference, it's more or less defined as, well, that's just how they are, and we include it in the fabric of our communities. Again, it's not the sense of exclusion would come largely through acts of heteronormativity rather than any sort of homophobia discourse that happens. So, again, the work that I try and do is upskill and inform communities around the needs of Indigenous LGBTI people, including us that are older, as well as our young people, so that their services can be seen to be more welcoming. Because once they get through that front door, their services that are in there, they need to access. So it's all about presentation and behaviours around being inclusive.
Do many LGBT Indigenous youth who live out on country in areas which are far away from the large urban centres where there might be more LGBT people to support them, do they generally leave those areas?
Yes, and they often return. I grew up in one of Australia's smallest capital cities, and I'm 42, so I left about 22 years ago, and it was too small for me, and I went searching for, I guess, the spotlight of the city and even the safety of the city, and it didn't come out until I actually had left my hometown of Darwin. And what we've seen was a lot of young people, and where I particularly live at the moment, which is Broome, is those that do go, they go with a false sense of security to say that this is where I need to be, around other gay people and in that environment. But once they get there, they realise that it's actually it's just another layer of a community of trying to gain acceptance. And there's a lot of racism within the gay community, and I would even say that there is more overt racism in the gay community what there is overt homophobia in the Aboriginal community. So that becomes a real struggle for a lot of young people around acceptance. Plus, within the gay community, there's an awful lot of subgroups that you've got to navigate and to try and blend into.
Looking back to before the colonial era, were LGBT people accepted within their community? I guess it might be difficult to answer because you've got different nations and communities and language groups around the country. Could you make a comment on that?
I think as the discussion and the more that we have a discussion around the gender diversity and the sexuality diversity of Indigenous peoples, and we have that within our homes and in our communities, we're hearing more and more stories that are coming out. The role and function is still a bit unclear, but again, goes back to that point of difference where that's just how people were. When we look at the sister girls, there was a comment made a couple of years ago that the Tiwi Islands has like three generations of sister girls, which I found quite fascinating in that when transgenderism is a natural occurring event in human life for many people, then what was specific about there being three generations? And taking that a generation is about 25 years, I look back 75 years into this Tiwi Islands and what was happening then, and that's when the missions first set up on the Tiwi Islands. So I hypothesise that as the first time that there was a European gender expression of woman or female that came to the island. So therefore, the Indigenous transgender girls on the island, they saw how this European woman or white woman was presenting herself as female, and they then took on that as well.
I'm Barry Mackay for This Way Out, and I'm in Canberra, Australia, chatting with Damien Bonson, founder of Black Rainbow, Australia's first and only national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTIQ suicide prevention national advocacy platform and national touchpoint.
In many Indigenous communities, LGBT people tend to take on the role of maybe healers, medicine men, or a sort of a between the sexes, a sort of a bridge between the sexes. Is there any traditional roles that you know of that LGBT people filled within traditional communities?
Not within in Australia, only what I've read from overseas. I think part of it, again, what's happened in Australia with colonialism was also destruction of so many stories, and the stories about the roles and functions of those of us that are diverse in gender and sexualities has also gone missing. It's the first time I actually heard that story from the Torres Strait, knowing that the Torres Strait Islands is very heavy on Christianity. Part of my heritage from the Torres Strait Island as well. So I'm looking forward to actually to investigate that a little bit further, because that also plays into the part of our cultural continuity then. So if we can actually share with our young people that there was a pre-existing role and function, it gives them something that extra to hang on to about themselves as they are combating and navigating the world, which has all the ups and downs in it, but also those challenges around their role and function in society as both Aboriginal people and also as people of diverse sexualities and gender. So we can use that as a strength, and it's part of the positive reinforcement of belonging. I think for myself, particularly being at this round table here, where the discussion is a lot around Aboriginal services and non-Aboriginal services and government, one of the things I've been keen to try and draw out from the conversation, particularly in light of the movie that we had last night, Firesong, which focused on two spirited boys or two Aboriginal gay Canadian young people, is how our Aboriginal services equipping themselves to respond to transgendered people when they're coming through the front door, or gay or lesbian people. We can have the mantra that we treat everybody the same, but in reality, to in order to treat people equally, we need to treat people differently, and we have different needs. And they're based, it's again, the little nuances around the heteronormativity, the questions around, and this is where I think in the broader discourse of our country is that is around gay marriage as well. This assumption that if you're married and you're gay, then your partner must be of opposite sex. And so, what does your wife do? What does your husband do when you're actually your partner or husband is of the same sex as you? So there's those little things there. But also, again, our communities, I feel, to be quite welcoming and accepting of difference. It's just an understanding of how to present that back to the community itself and to the community of LGBTI people.
One Australian Aboriginal gay man who has had a successful career as a professional rugby league player and as an international swimwear model is Casey Conway. He has been engaged in youth work with LGBTIQ Aboriginal youth for many years now. I caught up with Casey in Sydney recently.
With your work with LGBTIQ Indigenous youth, what are the main challenges that you face, and what strategies do you use to help build healthy self-esteem with these young people?
Yeah, I think with a lot of our young Indigenous people that are trying to, I guess they're sort of trying to walk in two worlds, you know, with, you know, trying to be true to themselves and their culture, you know, including their, you know, their obligations and their, you know, their need to be a part of their family. You know, family is something that's really, really important to us, and sometimes, you know, there is a breakdown when they, you know, are coming to terms, you know, with their sexuality or, you know, some of their gender identity issues. So I guess, you know, with me and the work that I do, sort of helping them, you know, build that resilience and independence where they can, you know, confidently, you know, reach out for support, you know, and finding, you know, their place in the world, and, you know, and just letting them know that, you know, there is somebody that has, you know, done it before them, and, you know, and can help them move forward and build that life.
Any personal success stories?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see everything as success when, you know, when young people, you know, are able to sort of, you know, I guess become more confident in who they are and move forward and, you know that it will get better.
You can follow Casey Conway on Twitter at @CaseyConway_. If you'd like to know more about Black Rainbow, head to their website at www.blackrainbow.org.au. This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Wenzel Jones, produced with Ryan DeShazer, from Lucia Chappelle, and from Barry McKay. Goanna performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, WDFM Ossining, New York, KAOS Olympia, Washington, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Nearly every society in the world today is either a former colony or a former imperial power. How then should we regard and understand processes of imperialism and colonialism? Are they over, so to speak? Should they be dismissed as something we've moved beyond? Or does colonialism in some sense persist? Do its legacies continue to affect and haunt us today? According to Julian Goh, a sociology professor at Boston University, a body of thought called postcolonial theory has for many years sought to illuminate the workings of empire and colonialism, especially on the level of knowledge production and culture more generally. Julian Goh is the author of Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, and he wrote a chapter on postcolonial theory for the new volume Social Theory Now, edited by Claudio Benzacri, Monica Krauss, and Isaac Reed. When Julian Goh joined me recently from Boston, I asked him how important colonialism and imperialism have been to the making of modern societies.
Well, the claim of the body of thought and writing that I'm calling postcolonial theory is exactly that empire, colonialism have been crucial, essential for the making of modern society. It shaped modern capitalism, the economic system we live in. It shaped our societies. It shaped our institutions. It shaped the way we think about the world, the way we talk about the world. Everything from philosophical ideas about liberty have been formed in and through colonial relations to race relations. And even the very idea of race, some would claim, was formed through colonialism and empire. So the claim of postcolonial theorists is that it has been crucial for modern society.
Now, the modern empires were, as you write, finally dismantled in the 1960s. So you are saying then that the colonial and imperial past, in a sense, continues into the present?
Yeah, well, I'd say two things. First of all, I think for a lot of people, empire and colonialism is not over, right? America owns still, as a colony, I would say, Puerto Rico, other territories. There are First Nations and indigenous peoples who are still subjected to colonialism. But the huge modern empires that took over almost nine-tenths of the globe, they have been largely dismantled, at least compared to 100 years ago. And one of the things that, again, post-colonial theory, what I'm calling post-colonial theory, reminds us is that even though officially colonialism is over for a lot of people, not everyone, but for a lot of people, even though officially it's over, its legacies persist, so that even today as we speak, yes, there's a kind of presence of colonialism in what we're thinking, what we're doing, and again, in society all around us. So this is the other key claim. Modern colonialism for many people is over. As a political structure, it's largely over. But as a cultural thing, as a social thing, it's still, its legacies still remain.
A lot of people talk about inequalities today. To what extent were those inequalities, or can those inequalities be traced back to the formal colonial and imperial era or eras?
Yeah, this is a good question because it's a great example, I think, of how there are these colonial legacies, these legacies of modern empire and colonialism. And we could talk about, you know, say, international equality, a world of rich nations and poor nations. For the most part, a few exceptions aside, for the most part, the countries that are the wealthiest were those that were the modern colonial powers, and the countries that are the poorest were those that were colonized. And again, there's some exceptions and there's some complexities because it kind of depends upon the type of colonialism we're talking about. But for the most part, the inequalities and international inequalities, wealth between countries, can in many ways be traced to this colonial and imperial process. Inequalities between persons, I think, in the world too, especially if we're talking about racial inequalities, right, in a lot of different societies. The racial inequalities that you see and a lot of the ethnic inequalities between groups, these were also forged in colonialism. So this inequality on all these levels is a great example of how colonialism still lives with us.
You note in this chapter and also in your book, Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, you also note the existence, the continuing existence of separatist movements. So those you also want to link to or to be characterized as the legacies of colonialism?
Yeah, I think there are some current movements that are seeking independence, people seeking independence from a larger state. In a lot of cases, these are continued decolonial movements. And again, I think the independence movement in Puerto Rico is a good example. I think Catalonia in Spain, a lot of the independence movement thinks of itself as a colonized power. So in many ways, you can think about separatist movements, Quebec even, as a kind of continuation of the decolonizing process, which, you know, on a global scale really began in the 60s, and that these are kind of left over from that in a sense. There's also renewed separatist movements, I think, and I think these are also a legacy of colonialism as well. One thing you got to remember is that when the modern empire sort of took land, when they got together and agreed upon who has what land, and they drew up these boundaries and borders, they were largely arbitrary, dependent upon the whims of the colonizers. And so that process of arbitrarily making borders is still sort of hanging around and created the political context for a lot of these movements today.
Does the word postcolonial in postcolonial thought or theory, does it refer only to the historical phase or the time period after decolonization, right? Because that is sort of the implication of the word post-colonial.
Yeah, that's a great question because I think it's one of the most common misunderstandings that I hear from a lot of people that, oh, if you say post-colonial thought or post-colonial theory or post-colonialism, you are referring to a historical period. And in one sense, yeah, you can think of post-colonial period as a sort of reality that a country is colonized and then it attains independence, and then in that sense it's post-colonial. But the way in which I use post-colonial when I am talking about post-colonial theory or post-colonial thought, I am using it as I think these post-colonial theorists use it, which is not to refer to a historical moment or to say that colonialism is over, but to say that precisely because colonial legacies persist today, and that for many people we're still under colonialism, that what is needed is a true post-colonial mentality, a true post-colonial way of thinking. Post-colonial there is in the sense of a way of thinking, a way of looking at the world that has cast off all of those legacies of colonialism, that isn't bound to the way of thinking and seeing the world that colonialism has imposed upon us. So in that sense, post-colonial here refers to a future state. It's an imagined body of thinking. It's an imagined future society that has finally overthrown all of those legacies of colonialism which are still with us. So by no means does the term post-colonial imply that colonialism is over. Quite the opposite. It's all about recognizing the persistence of colonialism, how it persists in our culture, and it's calling for a truly post-colonial world in the sense of a world beyond the confines that colonialism has imposed upon us.
You're right, Julian, that post-colonial theory is also a critique of knowledge. Explain what you mean.
You know, these post-colonial theorists, and I should probably specify some of these folks I'm talking about, and I'm really referring to a whole group of academics as well as anti-colonial activists who have been writing lots of works and who were active in the 20th century and then through the current moment. Some of the people I classify as post-colonial theorists or post-colonial thinkers, whether they be Frantz Fanon, who was writing in the context of the French Empire in the 50s and 60s, or whether it be Edward Said, who was a professor at Columbia, a lot of what the writing is about is about how colonialism generated and depended upon certain knowledges. So colonialism in the early 20th century required knowledge about the other, about colonized peoples, about the peoples that these colonial states had to rule. And anthropology, social sciences, certain forms of humanist knowledge, these were, in that sense, all born from this need of the colonial powers to know the societies they're ruling. So in many ways, I would say modern social science was largely born from this imperial interest, this need to rule. And we still live with that knowledge today, and we still live with the forms of knowledge. We still live with the types of questions that knowledge is asking today in a lot of sectors of our, say, social science. Now, I'm a sociologist. The discipline of sociology is very complex and internally varied, but sociology was part of those social sciences that was first born in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and a lot of what it was doing, a lot of its concerns were shaped by imperial interests and concerns. And sociology, to some extent, social science, to some extent, carries that legacy. And so postcolonial theory is a critique of knowledge in the sense that it's trying to point out how these seemingly objective social sciences carry with them the traces of this colonial past. And so the critique of knowledge is precisely about trying to point out that knowledge can be tainted by imperial power and to think about ways of overcoming that problem.
Julian Goh is my guest. He is professor of sociology at Boston University, and he's the author of Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, which has been kind of condensed into a chapter by Julian, a chapter that appears in the new volume Social Theory Now. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you mentioned Frantz Fanon, and there are a number of other kind of first wave, actually, thinkers, first wave postcolonial theorists in your characterization, and perhaps others. So this kind of first wave of postcolonial theorists came from, as you suggested a little earlier, kind of an activist strain. These people were actually working on liberation movements. Who else was part of this first wave?
Yeah, if I may, I mean, I should clarify. Sometimes when you say today, especially in the academy where I work, if you say postcolonial theory, a lot of people have in their head a certain academic trend that largely began in the humanities in the 80s and blew up through the 90s, and this was in literature departments especially, and this academic trend was labeled postcolonial studies, and you had certain stars of this intellectual movement, such as Edward Said, Homi Bhabha, Dipesh Chakrabarty, Gayatri Spivak. And the way I think of this movement, that's the second wave of postcolonial thought. I would argue that those writers and thinkers we're really just drawing upon and extending, as you correctly point out, Siet, the first wave. And by first wave, I mean the scholars, activists who were emerging and thinking about the world precisely during the period, the height of modern colonialism in the 20th century. And so Frantz Fanon was one of them. Another I would include in there would be Aimé Césaire, the Martinican poet, writer, philosopher, politician. I would even include W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a sociologist in the early 20th century. You have other people like Amilcar Cabral, who was fighting against the Portuguese Empire. And these are interesting folks because, unlike the second wave, they weren't purely academics. W.E.B. Du Bois was an academic. He was a sociologist at Atlanta University, but he was also an activist, right? He helped founded the NAACP. Frantz Fanon was involved in the liberation movement against France and Algeria. Aimé Césaire was a politician, and Amilcar Cabral was an active anti-Portuguese revolutionary. So you have these core thinkers. I think you could add others to this first wave. I would add, for example, the Marxist writer C.L.R. James. And so, you know, you could put in a lot of different people, but that's just some of the key ones that I think about when I think about this first wave.
And the second wave, which, as you said, drew upon the first wave, what was the agenda of these scholars in the 80s and 90s and beyond? What were they trying to do within the academy?
I think, you know, they each had their different projects, and I don't want to, you know, homogenize them. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they shared a critique of contemporary humanities knowledge, a critique of literature, for example, what was being discussed in literature, a critique of philosophy and what was being discussed in philosophy, and what was not being discussed. And what they were, I think, trying to get their fellow academics to realize is exactly the legacy of colonialism and imperialism upon knowledge, in this case, academic knowledge. And in that context of the humanities, part of the movement was to critique the Eurocentrism, for example, of the literature canon. Right? And I think that this becomes one of the essential elements of this second wave, which was to point out that, you know, when we studied English literature in the 80s, it was, you know, the literature of white men, A, and B, and more precisely, this was literature that was talking about empire in the background, but it wasn't that empire in the background wasn't fully acknowledged. So what they were trying to do, I think, in their context, was to make the academic humanities kind of realize empire and colonialism was crucial for the humanities and to get rid of the sort of Eurocentric assumptions that really reflected this imperial legacy upon the humanities.
Well, you're talking about critiques of empire and of colonialism and an examination of the legacies of imperialism and colonialism. A fair amount of Marxist theory has been critical of empire and of colonialism. So how does, if it does, how does post-colonial thought differ from Marxist theory?
I think that when I look around at the sort of intellectual scene in the 20th century and through today, I would say that there are two main bodies of thought that have recognized the importance of empire and colonialism and have tried to think about its implications for society and for knowledge. One is, of course, these anti-colonial and post-colonial thinkers, the first wave and second wave that I've just mentioned. The other is, of course, Marxism. And the Marxist critique of capitalism brought with it, carried with it a critique of empire and colonialism, and recognized also that empire and colonialism was important for shaping modern society and that today has all these legacies. And indeed, some of the first wave thinkers, Fanon, Du Bois, they were influenced by Marxist thought. Aimé Césaire was a member of the Communist Party, for instance. So there's common ground, I think, between post-colonial theory and Marxist thought. However, I think there is a distinction to be made, or a series of distinctions to be made. And it's a complex issue, but the simplest way I would put it is the way that Aimé Césaire and some of these post-colonial thinkers at the time put it, which is Marxism is important for understanding capitalism, but as a set of theoretical tools for understanding the world and for critiquing the world and for thinking about possibilities for change, it's incomplete. Because what it missed was questions of culture, questions of particularly race and racial difference. And so the post-colonial thinkers drew from Marx, but were, let's say, unhappy with the way in which at least certain variants of Marxism ignored race and kind of reduced everything to class. Now, you know, this is, I think, a fair critique, because the Communist Party that M.A. Césaire was a member of, and which he later resigned from precisely because they overlooked questions of race. The Communist Party, these other strands of Marxism, I think, can be accused of overlooking the importance of race. And for the postcolonial thinkers, empire and colonialism is all about race. It was built upon racial difference. It brought with it all of these racial inequalities. And so it's crucial to focus upon race. But certain brands of Marxism, particularly that of the Communist Party, did ignore questions of race. Marx himself, I think, it's a complicated issue which we can get into. Some might argue that Marx did write about race and talk about race, and there's a great book by Kevin Anderson called Marx at the Margins, who points out that Marx has all these journalistic writings about the Civil War and about other issues which did incorporate questions of race. But, you know, my own contention, and I think this would be the contention of some of the other postcolonial thinkers, is that even then, even, you know, granted that there's a type of Marxism that did talk about race, I still think that Marx's theory of capitalism can be accused of sort of bracketing race under the rug and really not taking it seriously enough.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Julian Goh teaches sociology at Boston University. His books include Patterns of Empire, The British and American Empires, 1688 to Present, and American Empire and the Politics of Meaning. And we are talking about some of the arguments he puts forward in his book, Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, that was published by Oxford University Press. Yeah, on this race question, so let's just take the agent of revolution, according to Karl Marx. He certainly foregrounded workers, the proletariat. And to what degree do you think his characterization of workers or the workers that he looked to for revolutionary inspiration, to what extent was that inflected by race?
Yeah, I think, again, this is a complex issue, for some very controversial. For me, it's quite simple, and that is that when Marx built his theory of capitalism, which is foremost articulated in his work Das Kapital, a three-volume, wonderful, brilliant work that analyzes and critiques capitalism and how it works and where it's going and all of the contradictions of capitalism. In that work, you know, Marx is really basing his model after what was going on in England at the time. And look, all social scientists, when they come up with theories, have implicitly or explicitly some empirical reference, some model, some example that they're thinking of upon which they base their entire theory. And it seems to me, from what I can tell of Marx's writing, when Marx is writing about capitalism and the relations between capitalists and workers, he was primarily thinking of the white wage worker in England. That was his model. That then informs how he understands labor relations and informs how he understands the development of capitalism over time and how he understands who the vanguard of history will be, who the proletariat is. And it's, in that sense, largely white. Now, you know, I wonder, and I think this is also the point of some of these postcolonial theorists and other strands of Marxism, like black Marxism, which is a whole separate school, which is connected in some ways to postcolonial theory. But the point there is that, you know, what if Marx had based his theory not on the wage relation between the white employer and the white worker in England, but rather the slave owner and the slave on the Caribbean plantation in the 18th century? What if he had based his whole model of capitalism upon that? Well, his theory would probably look different. His idea of who the vanguard or the revolutionary agent would probably be different too, and it would be not white workers. So, you know, this modeling one's social theory after Europe, this kind of Eurocentrism, does lead to certain political visions about who should lead the revolution, so to speak. That, you know, I think in many ways Marx can be rightfully accused of overlooking the vast majority of types of workers around the world, not least slave workers.
Didn't Karl Marx, by talking about primitive accumulation, didn't he recognize and acknowledge how the extraction and the appropriation of resources from colonized parts of the world, fed into the expansion of capitalism?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. There is that wonderful section in Capital and in some of his other writings where he says that the wealth of Europe was built upon this wealth from the colonies, and that there was a process that he called primitive accumulation, which was a violent process, the early stages of colonialism, of the British going in and just taking land in India violently. And this whole process that he calls primitive accumulation, which he does say was important for capitalism, but I think the critique from the post-colonial side is that what Marx didn't do is recognize the continuing importance of those forms of accumulation. That, you know, one reading of Marx is that he relegated primitive accumulation to a passing phase, right? It's something that happens early in capitalism and then disappears once capitalism takes off, and then capitalism takes on this basic wage labor, free wage labor form. Now, I think that this, for post-colonial scholars who are, you know, remember, they're writing and thinking about how capitalism looks, not from England or the United States necessarily, but how it looks from the Caribbean, from Asia, from Africa. And when you look at labor in those contexts and you look at capitalism in those contexts, I think it becomes hard to say that the forms of violence and coercion that Marx talked about with primitive accumulation, it's hard to say that that was a sort of passing phase that just sort of went away and that was the basis for capitalism. I mean, from the perspective of the global South and the colonized world at the time, primitive accumulation was a continual process. Colonialism continued to be violent. Labor continued to be not a free wage labor relation, but involving all kinds of coerced labor that, yes, even after formal slavery ended, there was these continued forms of coercive labor. So this is another example of where Marx's theory, I think, for post-colonial theorists is somewhat helpful, but also kind of relegates questions of race, relegates things like primitive accumulation, relegates all these things that for post-colonial thinkers are crucial for what's going on in the world. He relegates them to the kind of theoretical margins, and that is a problem.
And if we move beyond Marx, I mean, to what extent is kind of a hallmark of post-colonial thought this critique of Eurocentrism, not just in a thinker like Marx, but really in many thinkers, this desire to move away from seeing Europe as sort of the center of all things and the originator of all things?
Yeah, I think this is one of the legacies of the what I would call the imperial episteme, that is the way in which imperial powers and certain people, certain elites in the imperial metropoles looked about the world and thought about the world. That's what I'm calling the imperial episteme. I think one of the legacies of the imperial episteme is precisely this Eurocentrism, but not Eurocentrism in this kind of sense of, oh, I have an attitude that Europe is superior. Eurocentrism as a kind of way of thinking. Eurocentrism in the meaning of assuming that Europe is the center of history, the originator of history, that Europeans are the sole agents of history, and they are the builders of history. This persists not just in popular discourse, and I could give you lots of interesting examples, but it persists also in certain sectors of social thought, in certain sectors of social science. So this idea that the white European settlers, for example, are the sole agents of history, there are theories, for example, that take that remnant of the imperial episteme, that take that as fact and say that, well, you know, when you look historically, the countries that did the best economically were those that had white settlers, right? Because white settlers brought all these wonderful institutions. That's a kind of theory that gets kicked around. Certain empirical evidence is marshaled for it. But that's a theory that is reflective of this Eurocentric assumption that white imperialists are the only makers of history. And that is also reflected in popular discourse. When you see, for example, certain American nativist movements today. I mean, nativist as in this idea that America, you know, America first, and their claims that, you know, Mexicans and Chinese need to get out of America because, you know, Americans are the ones, white Americans are the ones that built this country. That's the same discourse as this theoretical assumption that white Europeans, white imperialists, are the makers of history.
Julian Goh is his name. He teaches sociology at Boston University. We'll take a short break and speak more with him about post-colonial thought and social theory. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Julian Goh is professor of sociology at Boston University. And I came across a chapter he wrote on post-colonial thought that is part of a new volume. It's called Social Theory Now. It's edited by Claudio Benzacri, Monica Krauss, and Isaac Reed, and it's published by University of Chicago Press. And that chapter condenses to some extent a book that Julian Goh wrote called Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory. Julian Goh is also the editor of the journal Political Power and Social Theory. Edward Said, he identified and critiqued what he called the law of division. What's that?
Said's notion of the law of division, this is one of his interesting ideas that's tied to his larger idea about what he called Orientalism, and he has this book, Orientalism, which was published in the late 1970s and became a kind of canonical piece for what I'm calling the second wave of post-colonial thought. And so the law of division is a sort of law that operates in the imperial episteme. It's a way in which imperialists, Said contends, it's the way in which they think. Right? And one part of the way in which they think is to divide up the world into the East and West, the West and the rest, with the assumption that the West is best, that the Europeans or the Anglo-Europeans are superior. And the other related point of this law of division goes back to this question of the agency of the colonized versus the agency of white Europeans, because if you're an imperialist and you're thinking about the world according to this law of division, and you're thinking of East versus West, and that the West is best, you're also not only going to think of the East, you're going to think of it as this homogenous, you know, place. All Arabs, for example, are the same. That's a key aspect of this law of division and Orientalism. You're also going to think of yourself as superior, and you're going to also think of yourself as the sole agent of history. So this idea that white Europeans are the agents of history it's a part of this law of division. And what it fails to recognize, of course, is that white Europeans, the wealth of white Europe at the time, the advancements that they made, all of this was not separate from what was going on in the so-called East. It was dependent upon it. So the wealth from the colonies helped generate the wealth of Europe, and there was an entanglement or a connection there between East and West that the law of division sort of ignores or represses and still insists on seeing the East and West as separate. So it's a very interesting idea. It relates to sort of racial stereotypes, cultural stereotypes that imperialists have that are part of the imperial episteme, and it also relates to these assumptions about agency and who's really the maker of history. And for me, it's particularly pernicious because it denies the agency of colonized peoples. It forces us to not recognize that the history of European society is bound up for centuries, has been bound up for centuries with the so-called non-West. It's bound up through colonialism.
Does Edward Said's law of division, does that relate to M.A. Césaire's notion that Europe, I guess the notion was that Europe is kind of a self-contained entity distinct from its colonial peripheries. And, you know, to what extent did Césaire challenge that, and to what extent does that kind of relate to what you were saying about Edward Said saying, no, you know, the colonizer and the colonized, or the colonial nation and the colonized nation, are not, in fact, separate and distinct?
So this is one of those common themes that you see in postcolonial theory, and you're exactly right. It's an excellent point. M.A. Césaire wrote about in this book, Discourse on Colonialism, which was written at the height of European colonialism in the 20th century. One of the many things he points out in that book is that, you know, we tend to think of colonialism as something that impacts the colonized, right? That colonialism comes in and it either degrades the colonized, or to your imperialists at the time who were pro-empire at the time, it, you know, it civilizes the colonized people. But what Césaire pointed out is that there is a deeper connection that's forged through colonialism, such that it's not just that colonialism impacts the colonized, it's that it also impacts the colonizer, right? It also impacts Europe. And so Césaire's point was that the colonizer becomes in many ways corrupted by the colonial experience. They find themselves exploiting colonized people. They find themselves degrading the colonized and thereby degrading themselves. One great example he gave was World War II and Hitler. Césaire's writing around this time, and he looks at Hitler's occupation of Poland and Hitler's attempt to take over Europe. He says, hey, this is just colonialism come home to roost, right? This is what Europeans have been doing overseas for centuries, and now they're doing it at home, and that they're, in a sense, so corrupted by this experience of colonialism overseas that they're applying it to themselves in Europe. And Césaire's related point was, precisely because colonialism degrades and dehumanizes the colonizer just as it does the colonized, Europe can no longer claim, if it ever could, to be the bringer of civilization to the world, and that we need to look elsewhere for thinking about who's going to truly bring about civilization to the world.
So the colonizing nations, the metropoles, they obviously, you know, when they go out and do their imperial or colonial thing, they try and impose a kind of order on those others, right? Whether it be in India or in Africa or wherever. So in other words, they try and develop certain techniques for the maintenance of social order abroad in the colonies. What do you want to say about the extent to which those techniques were used or adapted by the colonizing power in the metropole itself?
Postcolonial theorists talk about and point to a number of ways in which, you know, colonialism comes home to roost. One example I can give from my recent research is on the militarization of the police. Now, we tend to think of the militarization of the police as something that's happened only recently in the United States, but in the early 20th century, police departments were also militarizing in the sense of trying to mimic and use military techniques. Well, one of the things that was going on at the time was the Philippine-American War and the occupation of the Philippines by the United States and the American army overseas to suppress the independence movement in the Philippines was developing various counterinsurgency techniques. And these then appear back home, used by the police, actually, because some of the police chiefs of departments in the United States had served in the Philippine-American War. And so in the 1910s and 1920s, for example, newspapers started writing about how this torture technique called the water cure, which is a variant of waterboarding, if you remember from the Iraq War, the water cure was being used by police on U.S. citizens in American cities. Now, the water cure was a method of interrogation that the Americans first used where? Well, they used in the Philippines against Filipino insurgents. So that's another example of how things that were being done in the colonies sort of come home and impact the colonizing societies as well.
Yeah, impacts specifically marginalized people within those colonizing societies, or maybe we should say agitators, dissenters within those colonizing societies.
Yes, and so the other interesting thing about some of these post-colonial thinkers is that they're pointing out equivalences between the way in which colonizers are treating colonized people overseas and the way in which populations within the metropole, right, in the American case, African Americans, maybe Chinese, Hispanics, are treated by the state as well. And there's all these equivalences between how these racialized subjects, both at home and abroad, are treated. And that's another sort of aspect of colonialism, and it's another legacy of colonialism.
Julian Goh is his name. He is professor of sociology at Boston University. One of his books is Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, and he's got a chapter on postcolonial thought in the new volume called Social Theory Now. It's published by University of Chicago Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one could forgive, or one could understand if someone like Edward Said thought, well, you know, we have all these narratives and they're all, and so many of them are Eurocentric and foreground and highlight and prioritize the narratives of people in the West and white folks in the West. Let's go our separate ways and just develop narratives that apply to formerly colonized people or people who are now subject to, you know, what you might call neo-imperialism. But Edward Said did not do that, right? He did not try and seek narratives or encourage the formation of narratives that were just specific to formerly colonized people.
You're exactly right. And this is an important point, I think, not only regarding Said's vision of what to do, but also post-colonial thinkers generally. And if you remember, I mentioned earlier one of the key aspects of, well, one of the projects of post-colonial thought is to create knowledge that goes beyond the imperial episteme. So it's post-colonial in the sense that it goes beyond the confines of colonialist thinking and tries to transcend these colonialist ways of thinking. And the immediate thought that someone might have about how to create this post-colonial knowledge, right? How to overcome this problem of the law of division or overcome this problem of overlooking the agency of colonized peoples, the immediate thought might be, well, let's just not look at Europe anymore, as you say, Theus, and just look at, say, let's write African-centered histories or Asian-centered histories and so on and so on. Now, I think that there's something to that, but that's not really what Said and I think these other post-colonial thinkers truly meant when they're envisioning a post-colonial knowledge. Because, I mean, Said points out the problem with that is that it's a kind of reverse Orientalism. Now, not reverse racism, which is a different term, but it reinscribes and reproduces the law of division, right? So you replace Eurocentrism with an Afrocentrism. And what that misses are these precisely the connections, the shared histories, the entangled histories, and the relations between these two places. And so you can't just replace Eurocentrism with an Afrocentrism. Doing so will reproduce the very law of division that was in the imperial episteme and that one is ostensibly trying to overcome. One way to really overcome the law of division is to recognize these connections, to recognize these relations, rather than sort of just focus on one side or the other.
You mentioned earlier about how postcolonial theorists say that so much of mainstream theory ignores people in the colonized nations, in the formerly colonized nations. One postcolonial approach is one that starts with the standpoint of the subaltern. How would you define subalterns or the subaltern?
Yeah, the subaltern, it's a weighted term. In intellectual sort of academic discourse, people usually trace it to the neo-Marxist thinker Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian philosopher, and he used this term largely in the context of talking about the sort of working class. But post-colonial thinkers, largely of the second wave, pick up this term as well. One branch of the second wave is what's called the subaltern studies, which is a group of Indian historians, largely coming out of India, who are trying to rewrite the history of India and to sort of deal exactly with this problem of an overemphasis upon the British colonizer or the colonizer's history, and to kind of write a history from below. And so they use this term subaltern. And again, it's a complex term, but what it really refers to is just the group of people who are marginalized. In any society, at any time, you will have a group of people who are marginalized by society, who are exploited, oppressed, and in some societies, that might be a group of people who are of a particular race. In another society, it might be a group of people who are a particular race and of gender, and so on and so on. And so the subaltern is a kind of catch-all term to get us to think about these marginalized or oppressed people in any context. So that's really the sort of most basic notion of the subaltern. And I think we can think about a global subaltern. If you think about the global system of the world, a global society, then you know you can think about these subalterns that are, in a sense, the group of people who are oppressed at the bottom of the global hierarchy.
And subalterns, they have, as many post-colonial thinkers have acknowledged and recognized, they have their own knowledges, their kind of indigenous knowledges. To what extent is the project of at least some post-colonial theorists the elevation, the bringing to light of these indigenous knowledges? And how do you feel about that? Like, is that something that you can get behind? Because it does sound a little bit like it's in tension with Edward Said's notion or belief that we need to construct narratives that are common to all, right? Because the experiences of the ruler and the ruled can't be disentangled.
Yeah, that's an important point, and it's a complex one. I think that what I would say is that the short answer is that the sort of focusing upon the subaltern as a way to rethink our narratives and to rethink our knowledge and our theories should be a starting point, but not the end point. Okay, so there's a crucial background here, which is that, you know, all knowledge is based upon the concerns and interests of a certain group of people. Social sciences, which is the disciplines that I work in, particularly sociology, was founded in the early 20th century, and a lot of the questions it's asked and the things it was concerned with, and therefore the research and theories that it produced, in many ways reflected the interests of white male elites in the metropole. So one solution to that problem is to reorient, readjust our attempts at gathering knowledge by taking more seriously not the concerns of white male elites in the metropole, but take seriously the concerns and experiences of the subaltern, right, the group of the marginalized groups. And I think in itself, if you just sort of only focused attention on the voices and experiences of the subaltern, that could run into this problem of not overcoming the law of division, because then you might end up with these narratives that are just Afrocentric or Asian-centric or, you know, subaltern-centric. But I think that when you actually look at examples of theorists and writers who did start from the subaltern standpoint, such as these postcolonial theorists themselves, I would say Fanon, for example, or W.E.B. Du Bois, a lot of their writings began from the standpoint of the colonized. When you look at the writings, you see that they end up not remaining purely Afrocentric or Asian-centric. They don't run into this problem of reproducing the law of division, because I think what they tap into is how subaltern experience is an experience of domination by these colonial forces, right, and the colonial legacies. And so by starting with the experience of the subaltern, I think that you end up overcoming the law of division, because the standpoint of the subaltern possibly, I think most often, offers a distinct lens that is able to see these larger global relations of colonial oppression, and maybe in a way that the standpoint of the white male elite in the metropole doesn't see. So I think, yeah, there are risks to valorizing the subaltern standpoint, romanticizing this subaltern group, but I think that if it's done carefully, what it can generate is a better understanding of the world that does take into account these larger complex forces and relations that the law of division and the imperial episteme kind of overlooks.
That's Julian Goh, professor of sociology at Boston University. What about this issue of the truth and where we find truth and objectivity, right? Because post-colonial thinkers, they obviously cast a very skeptical eye on claims of truth made in Western mainstream circles that highlight European and white experiences and knowledges. And then, but you're also kind of saying that, you know, we can't maybe totally throw ourselves behind indigenous knowledges because that would create a kind of imbalance of its own. So is there kind of an issue or a dilemma around, in your opinion, around truth and where it can be found and where it should be located?
Yeah, this is a very important question, I think, for it was an important question for the postcolonial theorists, and it's a question for actually me as a social scientist, as a sociologist. And, you know, we do have to understand, first of all, that, you know, the postcolonial critique is of knowledge in the sense that knowledge has been used non-objectively. The scientific racism of the late 19th century is a perfect example, and this is another legacy of colonialism. You know, the idea of race, I think most scholars will tell you, is born from the colonial relation, that colonists, imperialists confronted these other peoples to make sense of them. One of the categories they invented was racial difference and biological difference, and then they used that to justify their domination of the world, to justify why they should rule other peoples. So there is a real critique of claims to objectivity. But I think that I worry that some people read into that something different than it is, right? One of the things I think that uncareful readers or uncareful thinkers will walk away from after hearing this argument is that, oh, so the postcolonial theorists, they don't believe in truth. There's no such thing as pure objectivity. It's all tainted. And I don't think that's really the lesson that we want to take, and I don't think that's what postcolonial theorists are saying. I think that one of the things they're doing is, first of all, pointing out the hypocrisy to claims of objectivity, right? So scientific racism claims to be science and henceforth objective, but the postcolonial critique is to highlight how actually it's used to justify and legitimate these structures and systems and institutions, and so it's not objective in that sense. That's the first point. The second point is that postcolonial theorists aren't saying that objectivity isn't possible. They're saying that we need a stronger objectivity. And there's a philosopher named Sandra Harding who talks about this in the context of feminist theory, and she calls it strong objectivity. And, you know, it's complex, but the basic notion is that to critique claims of objectivity in science does not mean that you don't believe that true scientific knowledge is possible. It just means that you find that the scientific knowledge that you're looking at is actually not being used in an objective way. So my own take is that to read postcolonial theory as being kind of a postmodern relativism is very much off the mark. And I'll just give one example from sociology. If sociology is too narrowly concerned because it's following the law of division in the imperial episteme, if it's only, say, focusing upon the agency of white imperialists and not recognizing the contributions of colonized peoples, that's not good science to me, right? It's missing this important causal factor in society. It's missing how colonialism and colonized peoples are actually important shapers of society. And to me, you know, that's an incomplete scientific claim. So one of the things that postcolonial theory gets me to try to think about is that our sociology needs to be more objective and more scientific by taking into account colonial histories, by taking into account how the rest of the world has contributed to modern society. I mean, look, the United States has 4% of the world's population. Europe has about 12%. That means that the rest of the world, 84% the rest of the world, and yet, you know, most of our social science, when it talks about society, when it talks about what's happening in society, only focuses upon the agency of that 16%. That is not scientific, right, because it's missing all kinds of other things. So that's how I would respond to this sort of question about, well, you know, can there be objective truth? I don't think that that is at stake, really, with postcolonial theory.
That's the voice of Julian Goh. He is professor of sociology at Boston University. The book he's been talking about is Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory. It's published by Oxford University Press. And he wrote a chapter on postcolonial thought for the new volume Social Theory Now. Julian, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam.
And that interview first aired last August 20th.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.